determine whether Boar's Head products are linked to the outbreak. And from Washington, you're listening to NPR News.
For Kansas Public Radio News, I'm Tom Parkinson in 4K McIntyre. On this Saturday morning, it's 4 minutes after 9. Democratic Governor Laura Kelly and Democratic former Governor Kathleen Sebelius are endorsing opposing candidates in the primary race for Kansas Senate District 2, which includes much of Lawrence. Daniel Caudill has more.
Kelly is endorsing longtime incumbent Marcy Francisco. The two joined the legislature around the same time and have a close relationship. Will Lawrence is Kelly's chief of staff. He says Francisco has reliably supported the governor's goals, including Kelly's recent vetoes of tax cuts.
Senator Francisco has been there to sustain all those vetoes.
Francisco's challenger, Representative Christina Haswood, broke with the governor by voting to override one of those tax vetoes. She's got the support of former Governor Sebelius. Haswood says she's grateful for her support and wants to see more young people in office. For the Kansas News Service, I'm Daniel Caudill at the State House.
U.S. Senator Jerry Moran, Kansas Republican, joined leaders at the University of Kansas yesterday to announce funding for the KU Cancer Center and Health System. Moran announced a federal investment of $10 million to go toward a new cancer research and patient care facility at KU's Kansas City, Kansas campus. Moran says he hopes the federal funding will speed research at the facility.
What I've always thought that research, medical research, was about is hope that things are going to improve, get better, and we're going to rid ourselves of this terribly damaging disease.
Moran announced an additional $10 million allocated for cardiovascular equipment for the University of Kansas Health System. He says he hopes that working on additional federal resources for these projects that it bring more money in the future. 9 athletes with ties to the University of Kansas are competing in the Paris 2024 Olympics. KU Athletics says that the Jayhawks will be represented across multiple sports, including track and field competitions. And former Jayhawk basketball standout Joel Embiid will be competing on Team USA for men's basketball. In sports, the Kansas City Royals shut out the Chicago Cubs last night in Kansas City. The score 6-0. That series continues tonight and tomorrow afternoon. It's 6 minutes after 9.
A few months, the American people will choose the course of
NPR News. And you're listening to NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday here on Kansas Public Radio, your place for NPR News. I'm Tom Parkinson in 4K McIntyre this morning, taking a few days off. Coming up, as Weekend Edition continues, land that is both beautiful and critical to wildlife migration could be auctioned off by the state of Wyoming. We'll hear more about that story. That's ahead on Weekend Edition here on Kansas Public Radio.
Support for KPR comes from Pines Garden and Market, carrying a full line of farm-fresh local produce, including tomatoes, sweet corn, peaches, and other grades of Midwestern produce. Open 7 days a week in North Lawrence. Details at PinesGardenMarket.com.
You're listening to Weekend Edition Saturday on Kansas Public Radio. You can find us online anytime at kansaspublicradio.org. Or, as Scott Simon said a little while ago, just turn on your radio. We're at 91.5 in Lawrence, 89.7 Emporia, and a number of other frequencies throughout the entire eastern part of the state. Check them all out on our website, where you can listen live if you like, kansaspublicradio.org. KPR continues to expand its news coverage because of support from more than 5,000 listeners, folks just like you. In-depth reporting matters so much to these members, they're willing to send $10 or $20 or more every month to ensure this service continues to grow. Their support really matters, and yours does too. Take a minute. Go to kansaspublicradio.org and make a donation today. And thanks for your support.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Bank of America, offering access to resources and digital tools designed to help local to global companies make moves for their businesses. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Progressive, with small business insurance for protecting...
This is NPR News.
Vice President Kamala Harris is opening a new chapter. She begins her run for president, but she's relying on her past as a courtroom prosecutor to assure voters she has the experience to take on former President Trump.
So hear me when I say, I know Donald Trump's type.
We take a look at Harris's courtroom beginnings and how they might frame her campaign, on All Things Considered, from NPR News.
Tune in for All Things Considered this afternoon and tomorrow afternoon, too, every weekend afternoon at 4 o'clock. All Things Considered starts at 3 o'clock Monday through Friday.
Support for KPR's Community Spotlight comes from the Sunflower Foundation in Topeka, with a mission to serve as a catalyst for improving the health of all Kansans. More information is available at sunflowerfoundation.org.
Just ahead, Scott Simon will speak with singer Edie Brickell and musicians C.J. Camerari and Trevor Huygen about their new improvisational project. They call it Heavy Makeup, and it has an album, Here It Comes, along with it. That's coming up as Weekend Edition continues.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at RaymondJames.com. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Joyce Foundation, committed to advancing racial equity and economic mobility for the next generation in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
We're live, we're local, we are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas. We are KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute at 90.3, K210 CRN Atchison 89.9, and K258 BT in Manhattan at 99.5. Online, find us at kansaspublicradio.org. Hope American. Join us tomorrow for Weekend Edition once again. We'll hear from Salika Knight Shyamalan, who grew up with a pretty famous filmmaker as a dad. Now they have collaborated on a new psychological thriller that follows a father and daughter at a pop concert. That's coming up tomorrow morning on Weekend Edition. Salika and M. Knight Shyamalan talk about making their new movie. It's called Trap. That conversation and much more tomorrow morning on Weekend Edition starting at 7 o'clock. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is next. It's 10 o'clock.
From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Bill Curtis.
And I'm Peter Sagal. Just when everything seemed lost for Democrats, a new hero arose. It's like the end of Avengers Endgame, but instead of the assembled heroes, it's just one 59-year-old lawyer in a pantsuit who emerges. We'll ask about this twist middling, plus feminist punk icon Kathleen Hanna tells us all the things that she is rebelling against now. And Bill Curtis tells us about the spot that tingles when his anchorman sense tells him news is happening.
Where your butt meets your thigh.
We'll ask what's really going on down there on our quiz right after this hour's news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Former President Donald Trump campaigns in Minnesota tonight with running mate J.D. Vance. Trump has promised to make a return visit to Butler, Pennsylvania, where he narrowly missed being killed by an assassin's bullet 2 weeks ago. NPR's Martin Costi reports.
In a post on Truth Social, Trump promised a, quote, big and beautiful rally, which he says will honor the spectators killed or wounded at the previous rally on July 13th. The announcement is a surprise to local officials who say they don't yet know the event's date or location. At the last rally, local police agencies worked with the Secret Service, but there was still a security lapse so great that a gunman managed to get a clear shot at Trump from a nearby rooftop. Butler County Sheriff Michael Sloop says he learned about the return visit rally from reporters, but in an email to NPR, he says, quote, we stand ready to work with the Secret Service if called upon to assist them. Martin Costi, NPR News.
Since the shooting, there's been speculation that Trump was not shot but hurt by flying glass. The FBI has issued a statement that his ear was hit by a bullet or bullet fragment. As Vice President Harris moves closer to locking down the Democratic nomination, she's facing a growing number of attacks based on race and gender. Harris is the highest-ranking woman ever to hold political office in the U.S. NPR's Sarah McCammon reports.
Several prominent Republicans have described the likely Democratic presidential nominee as a DEI hire. Ange Marie Hancock, a political scientist at Ohio State, says the goal is to undermine Harris's credibility. Hancock says diverse candidates have to carefully navigate messaging about race and gender.
She's got to get out there and define herself, and certainly wants to appeal beyond African-American, South Asian women voters. While she would absolutely not deny any of those identities, she also has a broader set of voters that she has to engage.
Harris's supporters say the attacks on her identity will galvanize Democrats. Sarah McCammon, NPR News.
The Chinese owner of TikTok is challenging a law that would force the sale of the popular app or be banned in the U.S. It claims the law is unconstitutional. The Justice Department filed a response last night saying the company does not have First Amendment rights and the law does not interfere with free speech. NPR's Ryan Lucas reports the U.S. says the law instead addresses longstanding concerns about national security.
The department says TikTok collects a ton of sensitive data on U.S. users. That includes precise locations, viewing habits, private messages, all the contacts on your phone, even those that don't use TikTok, the department says. And under Chinese law, Chinese companies are required to turn over sensitive data to China's government when it asks for it and to do so in secret.
NPR's Ryan Lucas. This is NPR News in Washington. A small plane crashed in Wyoming yesterday, killing all seven people on board. Officials say three of them were members of the gospel quartet, the Neelands. Senior U.S. officials are calling on Venezuela's government to let all international observers into the country before tomorrow's pivotal presidential election. NPR's Carrie Kahn reports five former presidents of Latin American countries say they've been denied entry.
Mexico's former president Vicente Fox says he and four ex-leaders were told they couldn't continue on a Copa airline flight from Panama to Caracas. Fox said in videos posted on social media that other Copa flights to Venezuela were also halted until all the former heads of state disembarked. Senior U.S. officials said they're concerned about the restrictions to foreign observers for this Sunday's presidential election. Venezuela's socialist leader Nicolas Maduro is facing the greatest challenge to his 12-year authoritarian rule. Polls show the opposition leading by double digits. Venezuela's economy is in shambles with major gas and electricity shortages and millions fleeing in recent years. Carrie Kahn, NPR News, Caracas.
The International Olympic Committee is apologizing to South Korea for introducing its athletes as from being from North Korea during the opening ceremony in Paris. A spokesperson said it was clearly deeply regrettable and they apologize wholeheartedly. South Korea has sent 143 athletes to the Olympics, while North Korea has sent 16. The Korean Peninsula has been bitterly divided into two countries since the end of World War II. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
Here's a look at the KPR weather forecast. It's 78 and fair. Wind is light and variable from the east. Today, thunderstorms with a high in the low 90s. Wind will be from the southeast at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, clear with a low in the upper 60s. Wind will be from the southeast at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid-90s. Tomorrow night, thunderstorms with a low in the mid-70s. It's 78 and fair. That's KPR weather.
The following program was taped in front of an audience of real live people.
From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm the man with a gold medal in voice gymnastics. Bill Curtis, and here is your host at the Studebaker Theater at the Fine Arts Building in Chicago, Illinois, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Bill. Oh, thank you, everybody. Thank you so much. Really great to be back with you. Later on, we're going to be talking today to Kathleen Hanna of the feminist punk band Bikini Kill. They are touring again this summer, 34 years after the band was founded. We'll ask her what it's like to have to get your doctor's permission before you jump into the mosh pit. But first, we want to hear your anthem of rebellion. Give us a call to play our games. The number is 1-888-WAIT-WAIT. That's 1-888-924-8924. Hi, you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hi, this is Mary Cryan from Old Mystic, Connecticut.
Now, I happen to know Old Mystic, having been there.
No way.
Yeah, way. And what do you do there?
I'm actually a nuclear test engineer in a small shipyard in Groton, Connecticut.
Oh, my God.
Oh, wow.
That's where they build our nuclear subs. So when you say
yes,
you're a nuclear test engineer, does like do they turn on the nuclear engine, you have to go down there for a while, and you come back, and if you're fine, it's working?
It's a terrific savings in light bulbs.
Exactly. Well, welcome to the show, Mary. Let me introduce you to our panel this week. First up, she is the creator and showrunner of Girls 5 Eva, a fabulous show, all three seasons of which are on Netflix. It's Meredith Scardino. Next, a writer and actor who can be seen at the Williamstown Theater Festival July 30th and 31st in the new play Marcel on the Train. It's Peter Gross.
Hi.
And a correspondent for CBS Sunday Morning and author of the New York Times best-selling Rocktogenarians, Late in Life Debuts, Comebacks and Triumphs, it's Mo Rocca.
Hi, Mary.
So, Mary, of course, you're going to start us off with Who's Bill This Time. Bill Curtis is going to read you three quotations we found in this week's news. Your job, correctly identify or explain just two of them. Do that, you won our prize, the voice of anyone you might choose for your own purposes, whatever they may be. All right.
Okay.
Ready to go?
Yes.
All right. Your first quote is an official message delivered from a presidential campaign officially on Thursday.
Trump is old and quite weird.
That is the shift in tone we're seeing now that who is the likely Democratic nominee for president?
Vice President Kamala Harris.
Yes, indeed, Kamala Harris. Biden is out. Kamala is in, and Democrats are really jazzed. It's not about Harris potentially being the first female president or the first South Asian president. It's about her being a president we don't have to worry about on the stairs. Democrats are just an amazing change of mood because they finally have the candidate they want. Anybody else.
And she'll also be, wouldn't she be the first brat president?
As yes. Everyone's saying.
Yes.
Yes, she is the first brat president, or so she was called by Charlie, help me out, XCX.
Right.
She said Kamala is brat, and this apparently won her the youth vote for reasons I'm incapable of understanding.
I've been enjoying watching, like, all the pundits talk about, like, now, our young, of course, someone young in the office told us what brat is, and just like going and trying to figure it out.
It's very sad.
The funny thing is also it's kind of like a messy party girl a little bit who makes some mistakes.
Yeah.
Sometimes when you tell someone that, then they're like, oh, so it was, they don't like, she doesn't like her, she doesn't like Kamala Harris. And then it's like, no, that's a compliment.
Yeah, it's a compliment.
It's a good thing.
And she has to win Wisconsin, a swing state, and over there, they might think she meant she's a brat.
Well, no, but it's actually, it's so interesting you mentioned Wisconsin, because she loves butter. Like, these cooking videos are amazing, and there's a video.
Kamala loves butter?
She loves butter. Like, there's a great video of her telling someone off camera, she didn't realize she was on camera, how to make a Thanksgiving turkey, and she just goes all in on the butter. And then in a recent cookie baking video, it's the same thing. And I thought that is such a great swing state strategy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Do you think she's taking, like, big butter kickbacks?
Yes. Awesome.
Now, the question is, of course, everybody's talking about now. We have to talk about something, is who Kamala Harris is going to pick as her running mate. And everybody thinks, of course,
Joe Biden.
But that'll be a twist.
That would be amazing.
Because no one has said he's too old to be vice president.
That's true.
Vice president doesn't matter. We all know it doesn't matter.
Could be a butter Joe Biden. You know, butter, carved out of butter.
Yeah, oh, butter Biden. Yeah. Butter Build back Biden. Better, butter Biden.
All right. Your next quote is from a disappointed frequent flyer on Southwest Airlines.
This is the end of the People's Airline.
That person was talking about what big change from Southwest that they announced this week.
Oh, yeah, no more just pick your own seat.
Yeah, they're switching to assigned seating like all the old boring airlines. Southwest is finally getting rid of its trademark first-come, first-served seating plan. Now it's just like any other airline. They're even changing their slogan, you know, you are now free to move about the country. Now it's Southwest, free will is an illusion.
They're going to get pilots now, too, I heard.
Yeah, really. as opposed to whoever's like the first in line, born in group A, you get the seat way up front.
But wait, so the person from that quote is like, oh, it's all over? The people enjoyed fighting for their seats?
People loved it. One Southwest passenger told the Washington Post, quote, I woke up to a ton of texts from friends giving me the news. And another said he liked the old system because he was a, quote, dedicated middle seat enthusiast.
I feel like he's going to be fine.
You think he's going to be fine?
It's still the worst seat. You're always going to be able to get that seat.
Yeah.
The guy who said he was a middle seat enthusiast, he has a friend?
Yeah.
Because if he had a friend,
like
he wouldn't need to sit in the middle seat to meet
people. Yeah,
does that sound a little bit like some kind of pervert euphemism?
A middle seat enthusiast? Yeah.
Now, what's interesting, Meredith, is apparently they're not doing it to earn more money to compete with the, you know, as they call them, the legacy airlines like United and American and Delta. They're doing it, they say, because the other competing cheap airlines are beating them on price, and they need to compete with them. And Spirit Airlines is like, oh, you're getting rid of open seating? Fine. We're getting rid of seats. All right. Here is your last quote. It's from the New York Times about where some people need to apply deodorant now.
Where your butt meets your thigh.
Like a big pizza pie, that's amore. No, that was not amore. That was the Times giving romance advice. Because what is making dating much harder than it was?
The heat.
Yeah, the heat because of climate change, right? That's the answer. The New York Times says that climate change is ruining dating because it's making us all sweaty and gross all the time.
This article was written by a guy who's would be sweaty and gross
probably
in 10-degree colder weather. Yes.
This is why I can't get a date.
This is happening to everyone that I've talked to in my apartment.
But you know...
I'm a middle seat enthusiast.
I was going to say, middle seat guy doesn't mind.
The Times, well, remember, this is service journalism, so they have solutions for you daters out there who are dealing with the heat. Apply deodorant liberally, especially to that spot. Choose indoor activities for your date. And most importantly, only sleep with them on a first date if they have air conditioning.
It's also funny that that's the spot that they picked as a place to apply deodorant. I mean... What's it again? Where your
butt meets your thigh.
Your butt meets your thigh.
I'm just going to say, that place does get damp.
Yeah. Is there going to be a whole...
It's fine now. Don't worry about it. But I just want you to know, in theory.
What about like in... You know, how are things in Norway?
Exactly.
Or somewhere where it's like a little cooler? Is it just Shag City?
Nothing's getting in the way.
Oh, you mean what they used to call Oslo, now Shag City? Yeah, I got it. Bill, how did Mary do in our quiz?
Like a mushroom cloud, she blew the roof off and won 3 in a row.
Congratulations! Thank you. Well done.
Thank you.
Right now, panel, we have some questions for you. And first, it's a game that we're going to call...
The Race for the Bronze. Because let's not kid ourselves.
So the Olympic Games in Paris have now begun, and we are going to ask you about some events that are happening there. Rapid fire, true, false style. So if you get yours right, you get a point. Here we go. Mo, true or false, after reports that the Paris Olympic Village would be furnished with, quote, cardboard anti-sex beds, an Olympic gymnast posted a video showing that you could, in fact, have sex in the beds.
I'm going to say true.
That is true. Meredith, true or false, he did it by having sex on the bed.
True.
No, it's false.
Ah!
He just did somersaults in the bed, but no guarantees if that's not how you have sex.
Peter, did he stick the landing?
Yeah. Peter, true or false, the first American torchbearer in the torch relay was a first responder who had rescued victims of recent tornadoes in Ohio.
True.
No, it's false. The first American torchbearer was the senior executive vice president of customer offers and order processing at Best Buy.
So inspiring.
And Peter, true or false, after injuring his ring finger practicing for the Olympics, Australian field hockey player Matthew Dawson had to miss out on the games.
I'm going to say false.
It is false because he had the doctors amputate the finger so he didn't have to miss the games.
Wait, say the first part of it again? What was the problem?
So he injured his finger, his ring finger.
Do you know how?
Presumably playing field hockey.
Okay.
Apparently it was a choice between missing the games and letting his finger heal or going. So he went.
Wow.
Anyway, that does it for our 2024 Paris Olympics preview. Remember, it's not about winning or losing. It's really only about winning. And also, if you have recently voluntarily amputated your finger, do not swim in the River Seine. Coming up, our panelists go to work. It's our Bluff the Listener game called 1-888-WAIT-WAIT to play. We'll be back in a minute with more of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Vice President Kamala Harris is opening a new chapter. She begins her run for president, but she's relying on her past as a courtroom prosecutor to assure voters she has the experience to take on former President Trump.
So hear me when I say, I know Donald Trump's type.
We take a look at Harris's courtroom beginnings and how they might frame her campaign, with All Things Considered, from NPR News.
All Things Considered is today at 4, right here on KPR, your place to find NPR News. From the University of Kansas, we're 91.5 Lawrence, 91.3 Junction City, and online at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining us for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on a Saturday morning. Our forecast is for sunshine today in northeast Kansas, the high in the upper 80s, clear tonight, down to 71 degrees. Tomorrow, sunshine, highs in the low 90s. It's Kansas Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Easy Cater, committed to helping companies from nonprofits to the Fortune 500 find food for meetings and company events with online ordering and 24/7 live support. Learn more at easycater.com. And Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at raymondjames.com. From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Bill Curtis. We're playing this week with Peter Gross, Bo Rocca, and Meredith Scardino. And here again is your host at the Studebaker Theater in Chicago, Illinois, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you so much. Right now, it is time for the Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me Bluff the Listener game. Call 1-888-WAIT-WAIT to play our game on the air, or check out the pinned post on our Instagram page, at WaitWaitNPR. Hi, you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hi, my name is Aaron, and I'm calling from Jackson Hole, Wyoming.
Oh, my gosh, ooh. Jackson Hole, a fantastically beautiful place. I was lucky enough to be at once. What do you do there?
I work in operations for a hiking and biking tour company that takes people on trips in Grand Teton and Yellowstone National Park.
Oh, wow, that sounds like a dream job, am I right?
Yeah, it's a dream job. I love it.
Right. Well, Aaron, it's great to have you with us. You're going to play our game in which you must tell truth from fiction. Bill, what is Aaron's topic?
Not safe for work.
There's all kind of faux pas one can do at the office, drink all the coffee without refilling it, stealing all the company's secrets, selling them to the Chinese. Our panelists are going to tell you about something someone did at the office that raised a few eyebrows, cause some problems. Pick the real one, and you'll win the Wait Waiter of your choice on your voicemail. Are you ready to play?
I am ready.
All right. First, let's hear from Peter Gross.
Oberg's Technologies is a small, growing company that wanted to ease the workload of their overstressed staff. But instead of hiring new workers, which would be too expensive, they employed the services of a 4-foot-5-inch AI robot named Quickie, a strange portmanteau of co-worker reality. The bosses wanted Quickie to have a human touch, so they allowed it to sit in on meetings, listen to conversations in the break room, and generally observe their work habits. When Quickie went live this week, it mimicked human office behavior a little too well. It stole people's lunches. It microwaved fish in the kitchen. It started coming in late and saying it had car trouble. It even asked to leave early, saying it, quote, probably had COVID, and then went to a baseball game. Then, in a bizarre mashup of excuses, it requested the whole week off because its grandmother was dying and also having a baby. Oberg's Technologies was thoroughly embarrassed and had to apologize to irate customers because they had just sold and shipped 1,000 units of their latest invention, a 4-foot-5-inch AI robot named Quickie.
A company hires a robot to be an employee, and it turns out to have learned all the worst habits from its fellow employees. Your next office ordeal comes from Meredith Scardino.
Usually the only thing that stems from a cubicle that has the power to paralyze an entire office is the way one guy eats salad. It's disgusting. But at Protective Solutions LTD, a small packaging supply company in Stonehouse, England, there's something even more intrusive in the workplace. A tiny potted plant purchased 15 years ago and brought to work by the company's bosses has grown and grown into what is now a 300-foot-long beast. According to the managing director of Protective, the rapidly growing Hedera plant, quote, goes wherever it wants to, with offshoots tracing the ceiling, dipping down to the floor, covering desks, and strangling desktop computers. Displaying the cockiness and entitlement of an 80s day trader, and with, quote, new sprouts appearing every day, morale at Protective is at an all-time low, as employees gunning for a corner office have to hear, sorry, it was taken by the boss's plant.
A little bitty ivy plant brought in 15 years ago has now completely taken over an office in England. Your last workplace whoopsie comes from Morocco.
Zach Bagnoli had a problem. Every July, his Minneapolis-based insurance company hosts a summer souptacular party. This year, he was tasked with making gazpacho, the traditional cold tomato-based Andalusian favorite, rich with vegetables and spices. But Zach forgot to bring the batch he'd made from home. Luckily, for 14 years, he'd been accumulating McDonald's fancy ketchup packets in his lower left desk drawer. After squeezing them into that goldfish bowl that sat empty since the pandemic, he added some spice, courtesy of Taco Bell hot sauce packets from 2018, lower right-hand drawer. As for the crucial vegetables that make gazpacho a meal, in his upper left drawer, he found 33 packets of Heinz sweet relish from that Wendy's that closed during the Bush administration. Bush 41. Most people chose to sip Zach's nitratious gazpacho through the coffee stirrers he kept in his upper right drawer. Still, most everyone fell sick with a nasty case of gazpacho and sodium poisoning. Symptoms include feeling intoxicated and confused. Said Zach, I'm not worried. I just blamed Mindy and her Burger King mustard shots. Those things were disgusting.
All right. Here are your choices. Something odd and unpleasant happened in an office recently. Was it from Peter Gross, a company that makes an AI robot, trained one to be an employee, and it became the worst one they ever had because it learned well? From Meredith Scardino, a little plant brought into an office has become a giant monstrous ivy that is threatening to push the humans out? Or from Mo, an office worker in Minneapolis treated his coworkers to his ketchup packet gazpacho, making them sick with sodium poisoning? Which of these is the real story of an office mishap we found in the news?
I'll go with the story of the McDonald's and the soup pack.
Great. Done. All right. Final answer.
All right. Your choice, then, is Moe's story of the guy who made gazpacho with nothing but McDonald's
Thank
ketchup
you.
Packets. To bring you the correct answer, let's hear from someone who knows all about this real story.
It started off as a little plant in their bathroom, and Ali and Des brought it in here, and it just seems to like the environment in here.
That was Charlotte, one of the employees at Protective Solutions in the UK, talking about the monstrous 300-foot plant that has taken over their office. I'm afraid, and this is odd for a guide, you have been led astray.
The altitude.
So you did not win a game, but you did earn a point ultimately for Mo for his delicious recipe, and we can't thank you enough for playing, and I look forward to seeing you and talking to you where you work as soon as possible. Thank you so much for calling.
Thank you.
And now the game we call Not My Job. Back in 1990, Kathleen Hanna formed the feminist punk band Bikini Kill and, without really meaning to, became the face of the Riot Girl movement. They set out to smash the patriarchy, but 30 years later, it still seems to be here. So they have to tour again. They're doing it this summer. Kathleen Hanna, welcome to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. So let's talk about the tour first. The Bikini Kill was the first of many musical projects, or rather one of many musical projects you've done. What inspired you to get the band back together, as they say, and take them on the road?
I really need a beach house in Malibu, and feminist art pays so well that I just figured, you know, go for the millions.
Yeah,
no, I mean, clearly with everything going on in the world, we were just like kind of reinvigorated to sing the songs again.
Absolutely.
It just felt like the right time. You know, I didn't want to sing these songs 15 years ago, and I really want to sing them again now. They feel really like, it feels good physically to sing them on stage.
Maybe when you sang them 30 years ago, it worked, but the effect wore off. Now you have to reapply Bikini Kill. Let's talk about your background. I was reading in your book. I was reading your book that you recently published, Rebel Girl, which is a remarkable memoir. But I was surprised by so many things in it. One of them, I was so surprised by your first time singing on stage, which you say in the book was like a really important moment when you realized like that's what you wanted to do. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, I got the part of Annie in the musical Annie.
Yes. If you're going to play Annie, that's the show to do it in, yeah.
Well, what actually happened was a woman who had a son who went to the school complained that it was sexist that there weren't very many parts for boys in it. So the play actually ended up being a really horrible mashup of Annie and Oliver. Also, you know, about orphans, I guess they're like, let's do one boy orphans and girl orphans.
Wow.
But yeah.
And then they were fighting each other. So it was like West Side Story.
I couldn't believe that because it's far from the worst thing that happens to you in your youth. But it was amazing to me that like there, you know, this girl who deserves this break and deserves this outlet, she gets it. And even at the age of whatever it was, 11, the patriarchy comes and ruins it again. It's like, so that's terrible. Did you in fact end up with a big fight with Oliver at the end? Only one orphan can walk away.
I mean, I did give him some pretty bad glares in the hallway, but he was like 2 feet tall, like, and I was like 4'8", so I really felt like it was not a fair fight.
Right.
And he was a very cute, sweet kid, and he made everybody cry with that dumb "Where Is Love?"
Where
song,
is love?
So,
yeah. It's a tearjerker.
It is a tearjerker. Can you still do, or have you been tempted to do the big song "Tomorrow" from that song, from that show?
Oh, I do it all the time.
Can we hear it?
I can't do it with earplugs. Let's see. The sun'll come out. I can't do it right now.
The next word is tomorrow.
I just drove here from Hershey Park, Pennsylvania.
Oh.
Where I was on roller coasters for like 10 hours, so I'm sort of like fried.
Did you just go to hang, or were you guys playing at that? There's a big venue there.
Oh, yeah. No, we don't play venues
that big.
It's
not that big? Okay.
Thank you very much.
You could. You deserve it.
Yeah, of course. I went to ride the Super Duper Looper again, because I rode it when I was like 10, and so I took my son so he could ride it, and he loves roller coasters. He's an enthusiast.
That's great. I was just there a month ago. It's thrilling.
It's thrilling.
It's a nice park. It's a nice park.
When you walk around in a big public place like Hershey Park, are you recognized by your fans from any of the projects you did? But I'm thinking mainly of Bikini Kill.
No, and oddly, the day that we went, it was Foo Fighters who were playing. Mm-hmm. And Foo Fighters, Dave Grohl used to be in Nirvana, and we were friends with them when we all first started playing music. And everyone was wearing Nirvana shirts and Foo Fighters shirts, and not one person recognized me. So as I was sort of on the rise, I was like coming to terms with, did I make the right decision? Like, should I have signed to a major label? Should I have, and I was like, you know what? My son is so psyched right now, and we're having a really good time, and no one's coming up and bothering us. And I was like, this is actually kind of awesome.
Yeah,
there you go.
That is great.
Yeah. Now I wish it would make the story perfect if it turned out that Dave Grohl had played Oliver in that production.
you did. I wanted to ask you about because people talk about your band like it started this huge movement called Riot Girl of independent women in punk and in music. And I want to ask you what your sense of your own legacy and influence was, looking back now. I mean, are you talking to, like, for example, a young woman who saw you, who showed up when they were young and saw you and were inspired to do something? I mean, what do you feel is like Bikini Kill's legacy?
I don't know. I don't really think about it. Like, do you think about your legacy?
All the time. I am entirely focused on death, Kathleen Hannah. Wonder what I shall leave behind. I'm surprised you're not.
But he's already curated his own museum.
I have. No, to my knowledge, I've never inspired anybody to start their own band. But you have.
Yeah, it feels super great. Like, when things like that happen, I was on the street and some woman, pulled her car over and was like, I became a women's studies professor because of you. And I was like, that's the highest compliment of all time. So it just makes me feel like I'm a super successful artist and like I do my job well, but I don't feel like I'm like a legacy icon or any of that stuff. Like, I'm really looking forward to the stuff I'm going to do next week and the week after that and the week after that. Like, I'm still making music and I'm still writing and I have a bunch of projects. I'm making a documentary about my my late uncle, who is the world's oldest living drag queen, Darcel, 15, from Portland, Oregon.
Wow.
Yeah. So I have a lot of projects going and I'm always looking towards the future. I'm like a shark. I can't stop moving or I'll die.
Well, Kathleen Hanna, it is a pleasure to talk to you. We have invited you here to play a game that this time we're calling
Kathleen Hanna Meet Hanna-Barbera.
Mm. Oh!
Hey, you That's lit good. Up. You must know. I think you and I are similar in generation, so you must remember that Hanna-Barbera is the legendary animation studio behind beloved shows like The Flintstones and Scooby-Doo, and less beloved shows like The Partridge Family, 2200 AD.
Mm.
So we're going to ask you three questions about Hanna-Barbera, the animation studio. Get two right, and you'll win our prize for one of our listeners, the voice of anyone they might choose in their voicemail. Bill, who is Kathleen Hanna playing for?
Sonny Paley of Georgetown, California.
So here's your first question. Flintstones fans take the show very seriously, so when many of them realize that no one ever mentions what Barney Rubble's job is, they began calling the studio at all hours. The calls were so frequent that the studio responded by having whoever picked up the phone immediately say, "I know why you're calling. You want to know what Barney Rubble did for a living? He worked at the quarry." B, by making a special 8-hour-long episode that follows Barney's entire workday minute by minute. Or C, by just canceling the show out of spite.
Oh, God, that's so hard. I thought for some reason I was thinking he worked at the bowling alley.
Yeah, he just spends a lot of time there.
One.
That's right, A. And no surprise, the majority of those calls were late at night from drunk people. Next question. That was very good. After the Flintstones, Hanna-Barbera had another huge hit with Scooby-Doo. Now, in order to create Scooby, animators did what? A, gave an actual Great Dane LSD and watched how it acted. B, gave themselves LSD, looked at a Great Dane, and drew how it looked.
Yeah.
Or C, studied all the desirable traits of award-winning show dog Great Danes and then drew the opposite.
Oh, wow. I guess I'll go with the safe answer of three, but I think it's really two, but I'm going to say three.
It is three, or rather C, and I feel bad that you saw it as a safe answer, yeah. So they interviewed a Great Dane breeder about, like, what's the most perfect example of the breed? If it's a perfect dog, what does it look like? And she described it, and they just drew the opposite. All right. Though they were hugely successful, as we remember from our childhoods, Hanna-Barbera loved to work fast and cheap, so sometimes a mistake slipped through, like which of these in the Saturday morning cartoon Super Friends? A, sometimes a superhero's pants would disappear mid-scene. B, sometimes Batman's voice would come out of Superman's mouth. Or C, sometimes Green Lantern had three arms.
Oh, that's B.
Actually, yes, it was B. It was actually all of the above.
I love it.
Not a lot of quality control back in our youth. Am I right? Bill, how did Kathleen Hanna do in our
quiz?
She
killed the bikini. Kathleen, you're something. Not many people do that well.
That's true. Three right. Congratulations. Hanna is a singer, songwriter, and punk icon. Her new memoir, Rebel Girl, is out now. It is a bracing and moving read. And you get to see her on tour this summer with Bikini Kill. Kathleen Hanna, thank you so much for joining us on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell. Take care. In just a minute, Bill shows off his signature cocktail in our Listener Limerick Challenge. Call 1-888-WAIT-WAIT to join us in the air. We'll be back in a minute with more of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Vice President Kamala Harris began her political career as a prosecutor in San Francisco. But what kind of prosecutor was she?
We protest, build more schools, less jails. I agree with that conceptually. But you have not addressed the reason I have three padlocks on my front door.
Was the likely presidential nominee tough on crime or not tough enough? On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Start your day informed with Morning Edition weekdays from 5 to 9 a.m. right here on Kansas Public Radio, your place to find NPR News. From the University of Kansas, KPR's 91.5 Lawrence and 91.3 Junction City, streaming at kansaspublicradio.org. Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is ahead in 20 minutes, along with a news update from National Public Radio. Support for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on KPR comes from Eagles Rest, a locally owned custom furniture store in downtown Lawrence, featuring Stressless brand chairs and other sustainably made, handcrafted furniture. Information online at EaglesRestNaturalHome.com. Sunshine today in the KPR listening area, high near 88 degrees, mostly clear, low 70s tonight. We'll see sunshine again tomorrow, high near 92 degrees and some wind gusts out of the south up to 25 miles an hour. Kansas Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. Subaru, featuring the 2025 Subaru Outback Wilderness with standard symmetrical all-wheel drive and all-terrain tires. It's designed for paths not yet taken. Learn more at Subaru.com/wilderness. And BritBox, dedicated to helping people discover a world of British TV, including new original crime thriller Blue Lights, set in the streets of modern Belfast. Streaming at BritBox.com/NPR. From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Bill Curtis. We are playing this week with Mo Rocca, Peter Gross, and Meredith Scardino. And here again is your host at the Studebaker Theater in Chicago, Illinois, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Bill. In just a minute, Bill gets arrested for committing a white-collar rhyme. If you'd like to play, give us a call at 1-888-WAIT-WAIT. That's 1-888-924-8924. But right now, panel, some more questions for you from the week's news. Mo, there's a new form of deception, apparently, between married couples. It's not about cheating. It's that couples are hiding what from each other?
Not big purchases. That's too obvious.
That's exactly right.
Wow.
Stealth shopping is what it's called. Several people who do it were profiled by the Wall Street Journal, the go-to paper for husbands who get mad at their wives for buying stuff. And it's true. People are ashamed of spending so much money. One woman said she comes home from the stores, right? She smuggles her packages in through the back door and then hides them. One guy gets his new shirts sent to his office, then launders them so they don't look new when they come home. Makes sense. All of that is much easier than having a 10-second conversation.
And these are all marriages that are going to last
forever. Peter, the Washington Post reports that with the big rise in VR gaming, right? That's with the headset. You're in the virtual reality. Mm-hmm. There's also a big rise in VR gamers doing what?
Walking out into the street and getting hit by a real car.
Almost. Basically going to the ER because they're injuring themselves.
Yeah.
Now, you've heard, of course, of injuring yourselves while playing actual games in the real world, but now you can do the same thing without risking any health benefits or exposure to the sun. So, of course, right, you're playing VR games, you have this headset, you're wearing sort of headphones, you have immersive virtual world, you think you're igniting your lightsaber to fight Darth Vader right in front of you when you don't see that you're standing at the top of the stairs.
Or you're in a knife store. Bad place to do that.
Yeah.
Don't do it in a
so
knife
don't,
store.
So don't go into a knife store.
With no, no store. Cases. With no cases.
So you're like, don't, whatever you do, important safety tip, do not go into a knife store and play your VR combat game there.
Don't do it there.
And
that's
if
bad.
You own a knife store, don't let the guy with the VR thing in.
I know you want to be welcoming.
You know, yeah, you want to be like, this is the
you're
cool,
a cool knife store.
Store
guy. It's fun.
Yeah,
I'd rather
here.
You do it here than some other knife store.
Just imagine down at, like, you know,
really
a
10-year-old.
Cool knife store. It's like, guy comes in just carrying his PlayStation 5 and his VR headset. He puts it down. Says, you just mind if I do this here? Just
yeah, bro. Cool.
Cool. Whatever.
Yeah. Totally, man. There's no rules here.
Live in the present. The knife store.
Right. Mo, a team of Japanese scientists have published a list of ways people can reduce food waste in their home, including doing what before throwing out old food?
I mean, to eliminate food waste before you can throw... can you give me a clue?
Sure. It's like something like, I'm sorry, I filled up on bread first.
Oh, eat it yourself.
No, you can't eat it. It's gone bad.
Oh, you can't eat it yourself.
You have wronged this food, Mo. What do you do when
you apologize to the food?
You apologize to the food.
You got it.
A lot of things on this list, very common sense, like making sure that the oldest food that's closest to expiring is closest to the front so you see it, and telling your leftovers you're sorry before throwing them away. And you have to make it, you have to make it a real apology. It's not like, oh, I'm sorry that you felt the need to get moldy.
Couldn't you just get Nancy Pelosi to come in there and just take the food and tell it to leave?
Just pressure the food to leave voluntarily. She's good at that. Right. Now, the idea, you may be wondering why you do this. Well, the idea is over time you'll become so aware and so guilty about the way you're wasting food that you will buy more efficiently just what you need. Plus, you'll save money on electricity because you're going to open your refrigerator less often because you don't like how the pasta looks at you.
You have to also suck to be in a relationship with someone that doesn't apologize that easily, and then you hear them at the... freaking refrigerator saying sorry to like some fish.
I'm sorry, so sorry that I was such a fool. I didn't know love could be so cruel.
Coming up, it's lightning fill in the blank, but first it's the game where you have to listen for the rhyme. If you'd like to play on air, call or leave a message at 1-888-WAIT-WAIT. That's 1-888-924-8924, where you can see us most weeks here at the Studebaker Theater in Chicago, or come see us on the road. We will be in Minneapolis on August 29th and 30th, and check out the Wait Wait stand-up tour coming this September to Fort Lauderdale, Tampa, Orlando, and Atlanta. Tickets and information for all shows can be found at nprpresents.org. Hi, you are on Wait Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hi, Jennifer Hill. I'm from Decatur, Georgia.
Decatur. I know all about Decatur, east of downtown Atlanta, right?
Correct.
Absolutely. I know it well. What do you do there?
I am an assistant professor at Agnes Scott College.
Agnes Scott College, I have not heard of, though that's a pretty cool thing. What do you teach?
Chemistry.
Chemistry. Oh, you're one of those real professors.
You can't teach chemistry. You either have it or you don't.
Well, welcome to the show, Jennifer. Bill Curtis is going to read you three news-related limericks with the last word or phrase missing from each. If you can fill in that last word or phrase correctly in two of the limericks, you'll be a winner. Ready to go?
Yes.
Here's your first limerick.
Here's a tweet from a CNN fixture showing off his eponymous spritzer. It's a fun brunch with booze when, oh no, breaking news. Get back to the office, Wolf.
Blitzer,
yes. What could it possibly be but Wolf Blitzer? So it's last Sunday. Just picture this. And you're Wolf Blitzer, and you work all the time. You're on TV all the time, and you finally take a break. Oh, my God. Nothing's happening today. You go out for brunch, and at the place you go, there is a drink called the Wolf Spritzer on the menu. And you're like, that's great. Of course, you got to have one, and then you got to have another. It's named for you. It's not like President Biden is going to drop out of the race today. So right before the news broke, Wolf Blitzer had tweeted a picture of himself holding up Wolf Spritzer, and he's got this relaxed and happy face of a man who knows he's got the day off. And when he did absolutely have to run into the office and go on the air, he looked sad, as if his Wolf Spritzer was just off camera with the ice melting. And he's not allowed to drink it.
Can I just say that years ago, I was in a parking lot of a restaurant in Bethesda, Maryland, and I was with my Colombian aunt, Julita, who was already in her 80s, and CNN is international, and Wolf Blitzer came through. He was coming into the restaurant, and she got so excited, and I swear to you, started going, El Lobo, El Lobo! Like the wolf.
That's hilarious.
She got very, very excited.
That's great. Yeah.
Did the wolf turn around and go, Guinness! Here is your next limerick.
Hi, cold baby birdie, I see ya. My tacos give me an idea. This wrap keeps you warm and safe from the storm. You'll be fine in this grilled corn.
Tortilla, yes, a Texas woman found an orphaned baby bird in the ground during a family cookout. Without a box to keep it in, she quickly warmed up a tortilla on the grill and wrapped the bird up in it.
Oh, that's cute.
And it turns out the strategy was surprisingly delicious. I mean, effective.
How does this story end? It could go two extremely different ways.
No, it has a very happy ending. They wrapped up the bird in the tortilla, and then they called a wildlife rehab center, who came over and found the bird safe and healthy after they brushed the shredded cheese off of it. Sadly, the second little bird didn't make it after it said it was on a low-carb diet and asked for a bowl instead. Here is your last limerick.
Most sharks would prefer to abstain, but much nose candy goes down the drain. It flows past the ports, and the sharks get a snort, because the water is filled with...
cocaine.
Yes, cocaine. A new study of sharks captured off the coast of Brazil showed that every single shark tested positive for cocaine. Every single one. This explains why sharks are always like, I have to keep swimming or I'll die.
Say hello to my little fin.
I mean, it occurs to me, like, apparently, like, there are parts of the sea that are, like, filled with cocaine because of all the cocaine that are being flushed down toilets. And I'm like, we're wasting too much cocaine.
Yeah.
There's enough of it to get into this ocean and make the, you know, the sharks cocaine heads.
There are people who need cocaine and can't afford it. And there are people flushing cocaine down the toilet. We have to, as a country, find a way to get these people together. Or else, what are we doing on this planet?
So wasteful.
It is so wasteful.
So wasteful.
Bringing Sarah McLachlan song up slowly.
Yeah, exactly.
Bill, how did Jennifer do in our quiz?
Yeah, do you believe Jennifer? She ripped right through it for a total win.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Well done. Now on to the final game, Lightning Fill in the Blank. Each of our players will have 60 seconds in which to answer as many fill-in-the-blank questions as they can. Each correct answer is now worth 2 points. Bill, can you give us the scores?
Yes, I can. Peter has 2, Meredith has 3, and Mo has 4.
Whoa, all right. So, Peter, you are in third place. You're up first. The clock will start when they begin your first question, fill in the blank. During a speech from the Oval Office on Wednesday, Blank explained why he dropped out of the presidential race.
I mean, if they're all going to be this easy, I'm going to be very happy. Joe Biden.
Yes. Following a global tech outage, thousands of blanks were canceled across the country last weekend.
Flights.
Yes. This week, the House voted to create a bipartisan task force to investigate Blank's assassination attempt.
Trump.
Yes. Blazing across almost 300,000 acres of blank in Oregon was named the largest in the country.
Forest fire.
Wildfire, yeah. For a number of incidents, Florida police warned residents not to blank on the side of a particular highway.
Pull over and let their alligators go to the bathroom.
No. Pull over to take selfies with a, quote, depressed bear who's been hanging out there. On Thursday, Disney reached an agreement with union workers to avoid a blank at Disneyland.
Strike?
Yes, according to data, Monday was the hottest day across the globe, beating the record set on blank.
Sunday?
Right, the day before. This week, a woman in Canada was ordered to pay a man $600 after a court ruled that the Coldplay concert they went to was not blank.
Was not the best concert that she would ever go to in her entire life.
No, that the Coldplay concert they went to together was not, in fact, a date. The woman said she should not have to reimburse the man for the $600 tickets because they were obviously on a date and he was treating her, but the court said otherwise. So remember, guys, for your own security, this guy got lucky, but for your own security, whenever you ask a woman to accompany you to an expensive event, always clearly say, I do not find you attractive in any way. Bill, how did Peter do in our quiz?
Peter came from behind to get 6 right, 12 more points, total of 14, puts him in first place.
All right. Meredith.
All over.
Yes.
Meredith, you are up next. On Wednesday, Israeli Prime Minister Blank gave a speech before Congress.
Netanyahu,
yes. On Monday, scientists confirmed the discovery of Blank 13,000 feet under the sea.
A sea worm.
No, oxygen.
Huh. Mm.
This week, Russia began offering Moscow residents $22,000 each to fight in the war against Blank.
Ukraine.
Right. On Wednesday, Taiwan experienced flooding after a powerful Blank hit that coast.
Typhoon.
Yes, after being criticized for his speech at the RNC last week, Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson defended himself by saying blank.
Sorry.
No, he said they loaded the wrong speech into the teleprompter after being accused of underserving customers. Chain Mexican restaurant blank said they're, quote, reemphasizing generous portions.
Chipotle.
Yes. On Thursday, the NBA announced a new $77 billion deal with blank.
Netflix.
No, Disney, Comcast, and Amazon. This week, fans of Hello Kitty were shocked when a spokesperson for the company revealed that Hello Kitty isn't blank.
No.
A cat.
It's not. During an appearance on the Today Show, VP for Sanrio, the Japanese company that created Hello Kitty, confirmed that she is, quote, not a cat, but an 8-year-old girl.
Ooh. In a cat costume.
That explains her cat ears and litter box.
Shocking.
Shocking. Bill, how did Meredith do in our quiz?
She's tracking well. 5 right, 10 more points, 13, 1 behind Peter.
All right. So, Bill, how many does Mo need to win?
Well, 5 to tie and 6 to win.
Here we go. All right, Mo, this is for the game. Here we go. Fill in the blank. On Tuesday, Kimberly Cheetle, the director of the blank, resigned.
The Secret Service?
Right. On Thursday, NASA confirmed that there's still no set return date for astronauts stuck on the blank.
In the space station.
Right. This week, the British royal family issued new measures to help combat blank on their properties.
To combat paparazzi.
No, climate change. On Friday, okay. SAG-AFTRA authorized a strike against the companies that make blanks.
Oh, the companies that make video games? Hold on.
Yes, it's video games. Good. Yes. According to the New York Times, several members of his family are locked in a court battle over control of Blank's media empire.
Rupert Murdoch.
Right. After an investigation, a teacher in India was fired when it was revealed he spent half the school day blanking.
A teacher? He spent half the school day on his phone.
Yes, he did, playing Candy Crush. After noticing his class was underperforming, the school superintendent launched an investigation and found the teacher was spending almost half the day playing Candy Crush on his phone. When asked how he could just stare at his phone all the time and ignore his students, he said, by way of explanation, who? Bill, did Mo do well enough to win?
Big news. He got 14, which is a tie with Peter.
Congratulations.
Holy cow.
In just a minute, we're going to ask our panelists to predict, when it's all over, what will have been the standout moment from the Paris Olympics. But first, let me tell you all that support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Workday. With AI at the core of its system, Workday is committed to delivering continuous innovation to prepare organizations for what's next. Workday, an enterprise platform for finance and HR. Progressive Insurance, working to help protect small businesses and the owners that run them, offering customizable coverages to salons, accounting firms, tradespeople, and more. Learn more at progressivecommercial.com. And BritBox, dedicated to helping people discover a world of British TV, including new original crime thriller, Blue Lights, set in the streets of modern Belfast. Streaming at BritBox.com/NPR. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is a production of NPR and WBEZ Chicago in association with Urgent Haircut Productions. Doug Berman, Benevolent Overlord, Philip Gotica writes our limericks. Our public address announcer is Paul Friedman. Our tour manager is Shayna Donnell. Thanks to the staff and crew at the Studebaker Theater. BJ Lederman composed our theme. Our program is lovingly produced by Jennifer Mills, Miles Dornbos, and Lillian King. Special thanks this week to Monica Hickey and Blythe Robertson. Peter Gwynn is Brat. Emma Choi is our vibe curator. Technical direction is from Lorna White. Our CFO is Colin Miller. Our production manager is Robert Newhouse. Our senior producer is Ian Chillog. And the executive producer of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is Mike Danforth. Now, panel, what will be the big moment from the Paris Olympics? Morocco.
The usually peaceful parade of nations turns into the 4-0 vibe as flip off other athletes and cut them off. Ensuing brawl causes massive pileup.
Meredith Scardino.
Well, they lit the torch mostly just to cover up the smell of the Seine. What people did to the Seine.
And Peter Gross.
The Australian 1600 meter relay team will lose their baton and then find a new one by using the field hockey player's amputated finger.
Nice.
Well, if any of that happens, we'll ask you about it on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Thank you, Bill Curtis. Thanks also to Meredith Scardino, Mo Rocca, and Peter Gross. Thanks to our fabulous audience here at the Studebaker Theater in downtown Chicago. Thanks to all of you out there in the world for listening. I'm Peter Sagal. We'll see you next week from Wolf Trap. This is NPR.
From the University of Kansas, your place to find NPR News is Kansas Public Radio, KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence, 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1 Oldsburg Junction City, 91.3, and KANQ Chanute at 90.3. Listen online at kansaspublicradio.org or tell your smart speakers to play Kansas Public Radio. Support for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on KPR comes from Pines Garden and Market, featuring a wide selection of perennials, trees, shrubs, growing supplies, and gardening advice since 1962. Open 7 days a week in North Lawrence. More information at pinesgardenmarket.com. Sunshine today, upper 80s for a high. We'll see clear skies tonight in the 70s. A little warmer tomorrow, low 90s, and lots of sunshine.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Before Paul Scheer became a grown-up, he impersonated one. When Paul was 14 years old, every week his dad would drive him into New York City to take improv classes for grown-ups. And young Paul Scheer was great at it, for the most part.
Oh, you're driving in a car. I've never driven a car. You know, when I make a mistake, they're like, oh, that's a funny choice. I'm like, yes, it was definitely a choice, not my lack of knowledge of what adults say and do.
From MaximumFun.org and NPR, it's Bullseye. This week, verified adult Paul Scheer. We checked his ID. He'll talk with me about how he broke into show business, the voicemail he got from Barbara Streisand, and his terrific, hilarious, and also harrowing new memoir. That's all coming up on Bullseye. But first, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Former President Trump holds a campaign rally in Minnesota tonight. He spoke last night in West Palm Beach, Florida, to the conservative group Turning Point USA. He said if they vote for him and he's returned to office, they won't have to vote again.
You won't have to do it anymore. 4 more years, you know what? It'll be fixed. It'll be fine. You won't have to vote anymore, my beautiful Christians. I love you, Christians. I'm a Christian. I love you. Get out. You got to get out and vote.
He did not explain what he meant, that it would be fixed so they wouldn't have to vote again. Vice President Harris is headed to Pittsfield, Massachusetts for a star-studded private fundraiser today. As NPR's Tamara Keith reports, the campaign is predicting it will raise far more than initially anticipated.
When this fundraiser was first put on the books, President Biden was still at the top of the ticket, and the campaign says it had a goal of raising $400,000. Now, with Harris holding a lock on the nomination, organizers expect the Pittsfield event to bring in $1.4 million, with some 800 people attending. The campaign says this will be the largest event in the Berkshires since former First Lady Michelle Obama was there in 2012. This is the latest evidence that Democrats are enthusiastic about the change on the ticket. Vocalist James Taylor will introduce Harris at the event, and other speakers will include Massachusetts Senators Elizabeth Warren and Ed Markey. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
The first world-class matchup of the Summer Olympic Games comes this afternoon when American gold medalist Katie Ledecky swims against top rivals from Australia and Canada. NPR's Brian Mann reports from Paris.
Katie Ledecky is the biggest name in American swimming right now with 7 gold medals. Swimming today in the 400-meter freestyle final, she'll face the world record holder in this event, Ariane Titmus from Australia. Also swimming will be Summer McIntosh from Canada, a past world record holder. At a press conference here in Paris, Ledecky said she's ready.
It's always fun to race the best, and I have to bring my best. I think they know that they have to bring their best.
In a preliminary heat here, Ledecky came from behind to beat her rival's times by a fraction of a second, but that was just a warm-up. Later today, a gold medal will be on the line. Brian Mann, NPR News, Paris.
The largest active fire in California continues to grow. Officials say the Park Fire has now burned more than 307,000 acres and is 0% contained. It's threatening thousands of homes. Officials say it began Wednesday when a man pushed a burning car into a gully in the city of Chico in the Sacramento Valley region. Officials say the fire's explosive growth was due to hot, dry conditions and combustible vegetation in an area that hasn't burned in decades. Wildfires are also reported in other western states and in Canada. This is NPR News in Washington. After more than 60 earthquakes in 7 days, Scurry County in West Texas has officially declared a state of disaster. A 5.1 magnitude quake in the region yesterday morning caused moderate shaking and light damage. From member station KACU, Alexis Jones has more.
The recent surge in seismic activity has raised concerns about the role of oil and gas industries, particularly the disposal of waste fluids from oil production. Peter Henning from the Center of Injection and Seismicity Research says induced earthquakes are not directly caused by hydraulic fracturing or fracking, but he says there is a link when it comes to the process of disposing byproducts.
The practice of deep injection of oil field wastewater called saltwater disposal has the strongest tie to the increase in the rate of earthquakes, and also a tie to the strongest earthquakes that have happened in the last few years.
Officials in Scurry County are working with the Texas Department of Energy Management to monitor the situation and are urging residents to report property damage. For NPR News, I'm Alexis Jones in Abilene.
The Justice Department says TikTok has been gathering information on its users about their views on sensitive topics such as abortion and gun control. The allegations came in documents filed to the Federal Appeals Court in Washington. It's hearing a challenge to a law that would ban the popular app in the U.S. unless it's divested from its Chinese-based owner. The Justice Department says it's a national security risk because the Chinese government could force TikTok to share data on its users or manipulate content to spread propaganda. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Luminescence Foundation, dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases and supporting land conservation initiatives, and the listeners who support this NPR station.
Now here's your weather forecast for the KPR listening area. It's 82 and fair. Wind is from the south-southeast at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Today, thunderstorms with a high in the low 90s. Wind will be from the southeast at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, clear with a low in the upper 60s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid-90s. Tomorrow night, thunderstorms with a low in the mid-70s. It's 82 and fair. Stay tuned for more KPR weather.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest Paul Scheer is in his late 40s. He's an actor. You've seen him on The League, Black Monday, Fresh Off the Boat. He's a founding member of the sketch comedy group Human Giant, who have their own show on MTV. He also hosts the monstrously huge podcasts How Did This Get Made and Unspooled. And as I said, in his late 40s, prime book writing age for established comedy performers. So that's what he did. But he didn't write the kind of book you might expect. Are there bonkers stories about celebrities in this book? Yes, there are bonkers stories about celebrities in this book, including Barbara Streisand, Eddie Murphy, and Christopher Walken. But that's not really what the book is about. Paul Scheer spent his childhood on Long Island in New York. His parents split when he was young. His mom eventually remarried. Paul's stepfather abused and neglected him. The home he grew up in was often chaotic, frightening, and sometimes violent. Scheer became a successful performer despite those circumstances. He became a husband and a parent. He started seeing a therapist, and for a long time, he didn't really talk about his childhood with friends and family. Not the traumatic parts, anyway. But when he started writing the book, those memories came out and ended up on the page. The memoir is called Joyful Recollections of Trauma. We're going to talk about the book in this interview, and a warning, that does mean we will discuss child abuse if you or someone you know is sensitive to that. We thought we'd let you know. I was lucky enough to get to talk to Paul in front of a live audience at LAist, our hometown public radio station here in Los Angeles. Let's get right into it. My conversation with Paul Scheer. Paul, I was going to bring my computer out with my notes.
Yeah.
And then when I was backstage, I looked at my notes.
Uh-huh.
There were two things on my notes. one was, I read your book. Like, I want to be
clear.
No, I have thought about this. But the two things that were in my notes, these are like the don't forget them things.
Okay.
Are how and why are you so into the Clippers?
Okay.
And just in quotes, meet Dave.
Which is a
movie that stars Eddie Murphy as a human spaceship?
Yes, and it is operated by a miniature Eddie Murphy.
Okay.
So
which one of those do you want to take first? Because we're getting into the serious stuff right up top.
Yeah, let's get into Meet Dave, because I feel like I don't want to alienate people with my love of the Clippers. So Meet Dave, I grew up loving Eddie Murphy. I mean, Eddie Murphy to me, there was no better. It was just, he felt electric to me. So my entire life, whatever he did, I was first in line. I loved it. I had an Eddie Murphy standee in my room as a kid, like a little miniature, like cardboard cut out of him. And one of the first like gigs I had gotten when I was doing Human Giant with Aziz Ansari and Rob Hubel was to be in an Eddie Murphy movie. And it was, I was like, I've made it. I'm going to be in an Eddie Murphy movie. And I got the script for Meet Dave, the Eddie Murphy movie, and I'm reading it, and I'm like, this is going to be great.
Well, you know, Dave, wasn't Meet Dave written by Bill Corbett from Mystery Science Theater 3000 originally?
It had actually a lot of different elements in it. It was originally called Starship Dave, and, you know, and reading it, it was like, this is a fun idea. Like, it's, you know, what it turned into is something maybe different. But it was, you know, it was this idea that these aliens are traveling to Earth, and the way that they're fitting in is they've designed a spaceship that looks like a human, and there's a lot of fun physical comedy and stuff like that. Anyway, I audition for it. I get it. I fly out to LA to shoot it, because I'm in New York at this point shooting Human Giant. And the role I'm shooting is Lieutenant Buttocks. Now, Lieutenant Buttocks works in the butt. And
of the man spaceship.
Of the man spaceship. Right. And my line, the way you meet my character, is it sounds so silly to talk about. The spaceship, Eddie Murphy, crashes into the planet, and we're doing a systems check. And they're like, Lieutenant Buttocks, report. And I say, sir, we had a gas leak. It was silent. It was silent, but not deadly. Right?
Great line.
Nothing
to the best.
You know, and so I was like, great. Got it. How can I mess that up? You know,
that was from when Whit Stillman rewrote the script.
So, you know, I get the set. I don't know. I've never done this before. I'm in a costume. I'm getting on the stage. And, you know, whenever they're doing like renovations on like a building, they have like a little small scaffold with like a small piece of cardboard, not cardboard, but like a plank, a wood plank on it. So I get in like a little cherry picker. They put me up on this plank, and there I am. And there's nothing there. There's nothing futuristic there. There's nothing space there. It's just me and my costume standing on an elevated plank. You get on this plank, and the director comes over. The director is Brian Robbins, who is now the head of Paramount. I say to him, I go, hey, so is there anything here? Should I be aware of anything? And he goes, yeah, it's a spaceship. And I go, oh, got it. Cool. All right. You know, now I felt a little stupid, but I'm like, yeah, of course. Yep. Got it. So the camera, you know, pans into me, goes right up, and, you know, the director yells, report, you know, sir, we had a gas leak. It was silent, but not deadly. And then he looks at me, cut. What are you doing, man? And I'm like, oh, I'm sorry. He's like, what are you doing? And I'm like, I don't know. I don't know how to answer that. I'm doing my line. And he goes, yeah, you got to like interact with your environment. You got like computer screens and everything around you. And I'm like, oh, I didn't know that. I was like, that's what I was saying. He's like, yeah. You're like, that's a computer screen. That's a computer screen. This is a computer screen. But there's nothing there. And this is the question that I did ask in the beginning. Like, is there anything for me to be aware of? And he said, no. So now I'm like, you know, again, you know, you're listening to this or you're watching me here, and there's nothing there, but I'm going to look like I'm touching things. We do it again. Sir, we had a gas leak. Silent, not deadly. It's more military. I'm like, okay. Sir, we had a gas leak. Silent, not deadly. And he gives me again. More intense. Oh, sir, we had a gas leak. Silent, not deadly. Then he walks away. Now, I know that's a bad sign. I'm on this raised platform and I can't get down. No one's around me. director's walked off, but doesn't seem happy. And like the AD comes over and says, hey, we're going to get you down from there. Is that okay with you? I'm like, yeah, it's great. You know, get me down. He's like, all right, why don't you go back to your trailer for a bit? I'm like, okay. Was it okay? You know, now I'm nervous. I'm like, was it okay? He's like, oh, it was great. It was great. We're really happy.
He like tells you that there's a camera problem or something.
Right. Yes, you're right. I'm sorry. I forgot about that. Yeah. He's like, yeah, we have an issue with the camera. Go back to your trailer. All right. Go back to my trailer. Now
I'm like, I'm aware there's no issue with the camera.
Yeah. Their camera's working great. And also we did it 25 times. Like, was it a camera problem the first 25 times? And how many more times will we do it? Go back to my trailer and I'm feeling the flop slit. I'm just like walking back and forth, calling my wife. I don't know what's going on because now I'm waiting. I know something is wrong. I have enough experience to know something is wrong. And I get this knock on my trailer door. Knock, knock, knock. Now, trailer is a ridiculous word to use. It was like an extended extended bathroom stall, right? So, and it was a bathroom stall. On one end of my trailer was a toilet with saloon doors. And on the other end was the door to the outside world. And in the middle was where I was supposed to relax, which was no bigger than like two chairs put together.
This is like a place to make Pruno.
Yes.
It's a prison that you're describing.
And I'm, you know, I'm just like pacing this thing. And so all of a sudden this producer comes in and now they're in. And now two people in this small space, it's really cramped. And then a third person comes in. And now three of us are standing in this place next to a toilet, so much so that I'm now over the toilet, you know, having this conversation. And the director is, the producer is like, you know, this is always the hardest part of the job, but we're going to let you go. And I'm like, oh. And then, you know, then it becomes this moment of, I'm okay with that. As a matter of fact, great. I think that's good. I think we should let me go. You know, I don't know what to do. I don't want to feel like I'm professional. You are firing me. I didn't know that this is something that could happen. And, you know, and I go, okay, yes, okay. He's like, yeah, just, you know, we want to go a different way with it. Okay. So I'm standing there and they leave and you're cool. Yeah, man, you're great. So happy. Oh, so psyched to have you. Well, not that psych, because you just fired me. And he goes, oh, and by the way, let's get your smock. I'm wearing like a smock that has like a butt on it. And so they're like, take off my smock. I give it to them.
Oh, I was going to wear that to the Oscars.
And so I walk out. As I'm walking by the stage that I was just shooting in, I peer through the door and I see that smock on this guy. I'm like, that guy looks familiar. Then I see, I think that's the sound man. Why would the sound man be wearing my smock? I don't know. Anyway, and now I'm trying to keep a stiff upper lip. I'm signing out, you know, from being fired. You know, I'm like, all right, so here I'm signing out. I'm walking back to my car just now depressed. Now I can let myself, you know, I feel like like Bill Bixby leaving like the Hulk town. You know, I've made a mistake and now I have to deal with it. And this guy comes running up to me. Hey, whoa, hey, man, where are you going? Where am I going? I was fired. Oh, no, man, you weren't fired. We wrote you a brand new part. I was like, oh, you did? He's like, yeah, come back in here. Come back in here. Lieutenant Buttocks, here's the thing. It wasn't right for you. We knew it wasn't right for you. We got something better for you. And I go, what is it? And they go, Lieutenant Kneecap. Okay. Now, this is getting into the movie lore a little bit more than you probably care to.
No, these guys are all watching YouTube videos of Meet Dave lore.
And so in the movie, they need to fuel their planet, and fuel for their planet is salt. At the end of the movie, they find hot dogs, which have plenty of salt. And that's what they're going to bring back to their homeworld, hot dogs. And I think one hot dog could fuel their entire planet because they're very small people. As a normal human fits thousands of them because of Starship. So he goes, you know, at the end of the movie, you get the hot dog and we're going to cut to a giant hot dog on your lap. You eat meat, right? And I'm like, yeah, I'll say any yes. And he's like, oh, great. We're going to get you a lot of jerky. You're going to have a lot of jerky in your mouth. You're going to have the hot dog in your lap and, you're going to pull the hot dog off your lap and you're going to say, sure beats protein squares. You know, we shoot the scene. I do get to meet Eddie Murphy. It was a lovely experience. All that was really fun. And I do say, you know, sure beats protein squares. And I feel like, okay, it works. Whatever. You know, it's not that big of a part, but it's good. In my mind, I'm like, it'll be a memorable moment. You know, a week later, I'm back in LA. The Human Giant Marathon has gone off to a great success. My friend is also in the movie. He texts me. He's like, hey, are you here? And I'm like, no, where? And he's like, on set. I'm like, no. He goes, oh yeah, we're reshooting the ending. And I go, oh, I didn't know that. He's like, yeah, we're reshooting the whole ending. And, maybe they didn't call you. I was like, no, they didn't call me. I did watch the movie, just the end scene. And they just reshot the ending. So I am not in it, but in one wide shot, there is a picture of a man with a hot dog on his lap whose face is obstructed. And that's me. And, when the credits do roll, Lieutenant Kneecap is there, but there's no proof that I am in this movie.
We've got so much more to get into with Paul Scheer. After the break, did you know that as a child, Paul had his own video store? I mean, not like he was like paying rent on a storefront, but he had in his room a huge collection of bootleg VHS tapes that he made himself and then sold and rented to friends and classmates and even teachers. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place to find NPR News. Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 Lawrence, 99.5 Manhattan, and online at kansaspublicradio.org. Support for Bullseye on KPR comes from Green Lady Lounge, offering live Kansas City jazz 365 days a year till 3 a.m. Green Lady Lounge is located at 1809 Grand Boulevard, Kansas City. Information at greenladylounge.com. Warm temperatures, sunny skies today in the KPR listening area, high in the upper 80s. Kansas City's Wiretown features two of the city's finest guitarists, Brian Baggett and Danny Embry. They're in the spotlight this week on Live at Green Lady Lounge. Join us for an hour of KC Jazz Originals, Live at Green Lady Lounge, this evening at 6 on all KPR 1 stations.
Hi, I'm Kevin Ferguson, senior producer here at Maximum Fun, a worker-owned cooperative. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. And Jarl and Pamela Moan, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Paul Scheer. He's a comedian and actor. He's also the host of the podcasts How Did This Get Made and Unspooled. He just wrote a memoir. It's called Joyful Recollections of Trauma. He and I talked about it before a live audience at LAist 89.3 in Pasadena, California. Let's get back into our conversation. I could pick 12 things.
Yeah.
To set you up to tell fun 5-minute stories about your career in show business. And that's not what your book is about.
No.
So why isn't that what your book is about? Why isn't that your book 12 Funny Things That Happened to Me on Sets with Famous People by Paul Scheer?
Well, I think that's what the book was intended to be in a weird way. Like I sat down to write this book because after doing How Did This Get Made with June Diane Raphael, my wife, and Jason Mantzoukas, for 14 years, I've been telling stories like that. Very organically, these stories come up. But I'd be telling stories from my childhood, and they'd always be shocked. You know, I'd tell them a story about how my grandmother told me, don't open the door to strangers because there's a rogue butcher in town. And I'm like, really? And she's like, oh, yeah, they caught him because one of the mothers came home. Their kid wasn't in his bed and was started making dinner. And she looked down at the chopped meat, and the chopped meat looked back up at her and said, Mommy? You know, and Jason and June, whoa, wait, what? I'm like, wait, yeah, the butcher who killed kids. You didn't hear that story? The lovable story? And they're like, no, that's so crazy. And what happened is over the course of 14 years, those stories have been cataloged by listeners of the show. There's YouTube mashups. There were these Reddit threads of the most harrowing stories of Paul's life. And they're like, you should write a book. And at one point I was like, maybe I will write this book. Yeah, I'll write it. And I sit down and I start writing it. And what I realized in writing was like that anecdote, these anecdotes are fun to tell and they are, and I can tell them on a podcast. I can tell them at a, you know, at a restaurant, at wherever with friends. But the truth is like they're only one part of the story. And I think for a long time, I had been holding this part of my life very much a secret, you know, to this point that, you know, there are stories that my wife didn't really know about my childhood. There's stories that my best friend didn't know about my childhood. And as I started writing these stories, I starting off with this idea, like, oh, I'll tell the story about the butcher. Oh, I'll tell the story about, you know, this. Another part started to come out because I started to tell the other side of it. And I looked at it and was like, oh, wow. Okay. This is a little bit different. And then I gave it to my, my agent at the time and he was like, go deeper. I'm like, go deeper. I already went so deep. What do you mean go deeper? He's like, go deeper. And it was in this process of like writing. Cause I didn't have a book deal. I just wanted to write to see if there's anything there that I realized like writing a book, I think needs to be more than just an anecdote. It needs to have some weight. I also felt like I didn't want to write a book about, for lack of a better term, like showbiz. I, you know, save that for Barbara Streisand. She's had an amazing career. It's an amazing book, 40-hour audiobook. Get into it.
You do casually mention that she once left you an answering machine message.
She did. Yeah, she did. I did have Mikhail Baryshnikov's New York City phone number. That was my New York apartment number. And I have all these Russian people calling me at all hours of the night. And one time it was Barbara Streisand. Mikhail, call me. It's Barbara. I want to talk to you about a project. And it was like, oh my God, that's Barbara Streisand. The unrecognized, you know, a very recognizable voice. And it started to feel to me like this book kind of started to, and it sounds silly to say, but like write itself, like it just started to come out. And I think that it's a reflection of a lot of work that I've done on myself. Like, you know, I said to a lot of people, like, this book isn't a therapy session. It's not trauma dumping. It's the reflection of years of therapy and work on myself and kind of analyzing things that I've dealt with. And I really came to this. I don't think I could have written this until I had kids. Because that actually had me look at my childhood in a very different way. So I wish I could say right from the get-go, I knew I was going to write this book. I was going to talk about trauma and the after effects that it has on my life. But it would be a lie. It really was like, I respect the process of a memoir. I respect the process of kind of giving people a little bit more because that's what I learned from the most. And it just kind of organically shaped itself from sitting down and telling these stories and then kind of asking, well, why am I attracted to telling that story? What is it about this? Because this is not linear. It's very much thematically it tells a story, but it's not like you can't say, well, this section is about my childhood. This section is about this. It kind of is all over the place.
I'll tell you, like one of the first times that I saw my current therapist, mm-hmm. she goes, I'm probably not supposed to tell you this. And I'm like, oh, this is going to be good.
Yeah.
And she says, you know, whenever you're telling me something really awful from your childhood, I'm actually find myself doing it right now. She's like, you're usually smiling and laughing. She's like, we see that a lot in schizophrenia. It's called incongruous affect. And I thought, like, as I was reading some of the stories in this book, I thought of you, one of the most sort of charming and often outwardly affable people that I know, sort of smiling your way through these really dark things.
Well, you know, the book deals with abuse on a major level. You know, my mom had remarried this man. My mom had gotten a divorce from my dad, remarried to this man who was incredibly abusive, verbally, physically, all these things. But it was a chunk of time. It was a bunch of years. And it was so commonplace, right? Like, so that, you know, abuse is mixed in with trips to Disneyland. That's mixed in with, you know, graduations. That's mixed in with life.
Like, it wasn't like an incident. It was just your day-to-day life involved that kind of stuff going down.
Right. And as a child, and especially a child that grew up in a time where there were, you know, no access to the internet, if I wanted to learn something, I'd go to the library. And because of my attention span, I would forget what I needed to learn at the library when I got to the library. So I'm not even getting that book to learn. You don't know what abuse is. You don't know. It's like, oh, my dad is different than my stepdad. My dad doesn't yell. My stepdad definitely does. My stepdad can, you know, choke me out. My stepdad will, you know, throw a pitchfork at me. Like, these are, but it didn't, the severity of that didn't really connect on some level, because it was just like, that's what it was. It's still hard to handle. I think where I feel it the most sometimes is looking at my kids, seeing my children, and seeing how delicate they are, how young they are, how impressionable they are. And there's moments that are shocking, and be like, oh my gosh, I was that age when this is going on. That boggles my mind. And I think that that kind of takes my breath away more than anything else. I'm through it. I got through it. I was lucky enough to get out.
I think that one of the things that was going on in your family, particularly with your parents, your biological parents, was there was no mechanism to stop and take stock in their arsenal. There was no, or at least none that they shared with you.
Yeah. I have a lot of empathy for my parents as a parent. Now, you know, and I love them then. You know, the one thing that I will say that my parents always had an abundance of love. I don't know if they had an abundance of tools to maybe put things in the right perspective or like, you know, I think I'm much more in touch with my own feelings and I can talk to certain things. You know, my mom was also living the same life of being abused, right? So she, you know, when I'm coming to her for protection, she can only do so much to protect me, besides putting her body between me and this man. But she's never going to yell at this man because she's got to protect herself on a certain thing. My dad, you know, I talk about this in the book too. My dad, you know, is like, oh, I think you're exaggerating, or I don't believe this, you know, not that I don't believe it, but like, it was hard for him to face that. And I think it was hard for him to figure out what do I do? It was a lot of asking for help and no one knowing how to give help. And I can look at my parents and say, well, they didn't step in, or people say, well, your mom should have done this, or you, and everyone could, it's very easy to look back and say everyone could have done something different, but we asked family. Family ignored it, right? Or did what was safe for them, which was not get involved. We went to a therapist. And the therapist is like, I'll be here and I'll protect you. And then, you know, after two sessions of that, she's like, well, next time I'll protect you. If it happens again, I'll protect you.
I mean, you're underselling that. Like that anecdote in the book really took my breath away.
Well, yeah, we went to this therapist and she's like, you know, a family therapist. There's something going on in the house, obviously. And she's like, tell us, you know, tell me what's wrong. And I gave her a laundry list. He did this. He did that. He did this. He did this. And so much so that she stopped me. She's like, I have enough. Child Protective Services was called to my house because I was running around in my underwear with no shoes on in the middle of winter because I was locked out of my house and no one let me in. And they didn't interview me. They interviewed my mom and my stepdad together, which is a crazy way of doing it because there's no safety in that. And they didn't do anything. And, you know, and that also, I think, gives you this idea that, you know, it gives you a real lack of trust in people, but it also is one of the reasons I think I had a hard time ever saying the word abuse, because it was justified by professional people. Well, it's not abuse. They didn't call the cops. The CPS didn't say it was a problem. And I think that that's a tricky thing to get over that.
I'm Jesse Thorne. You're listening to Bullseye. My guest is Paul Scheer. He and I spoke before a live audience at LAist in Pasadena, California.
This comes up like once a month on the show, so I'm sorry to people that listen at home and are tired of me bringing up the Werner Herzog movie, Little Dieter Needs to Fly. Have you ever seen Little Dieter Needs to Fly?
No, I didn't even hear this title. So
okay, so it's this Werner Herzog documentary about this German-American guy who was a POW in Laos. Mm-hmm. And it's a very harrowing film. I It's an amazing film. I'm not sure it's a moral film. He sort of leads him through his traumas. It's really intense in Werner Herzog. When he was a POW, he went hungry, this guy. And there's a scene where he's in his kitchen in Mount Tam in Marin County, like the, you know, most comfortable, bougiest place in all of Northern California, just a nice, beautiful, natural world. And he lifts up the floor of his kitchen, and underneath are just like 40-pound bags of sugar and flour, right? And like dozens of them. And he's basically just like, I cannot sleep through the night unless this is here. And I honestly, like, I was thinking of your, like, one of the big themes in this book is your collecting, right?
Yeah.
And I was like, Paul Scheer as a kid and teenager building his own video store inside of his bedroom.
Yeah.
Is like Paul Scheer's equivalent to having 40 pounds of sugar under the floor. Like to have a thing that is under control and exhaustive belongs to you.
Yeah. I think it's, you know, it, I think it was a chance to have control. Like as a kid, it was just like, it was collecting things like, you know, I was going through some of it as I was writing this book. You know, I have like tickets to, you know, Happy Gilmore and, you know, Return of the Jedi and, you know, every concert that I went to, like just these things, which I think in a weird way, when I think about it, are all these good times. There's a lot of good memories in there. Then I'm holding those close. And when I grew up, I was an only child, but I did have a friend, and that friend was television. Like, and I wanted to be in that TV. I wanted to be in those movies. So to have a video store in my house, which is, I just thought the videos, like, again, I'm dating myself, but I came up at a time where video stores were rare, right? It was like, who even had a VHS player? Is like, oh, I was one of the families that had a VHS player. You know, my dad had one and we would go rent a movie. I just felt like I could control these things that I liked, that I loved. Like, so I could have this collection of movies that made me feel good. Being in a video store made me feel good, right? It was, those were, you know, and look, and I think some people turn to drugs. I think people turn to, you know, it's all vice. I mean, thankfully my vice, you know, was, you know, collecting, you know, Beverly Hills Cop, you know, and Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, you know, and, you know, every cup that you could ever get from McDonald's. But that made me safe, or it like was a, it was a cocoon. And I think that those are these things that I often think about. And in my moments of stress, yeah, I joke about this. It is not in the book. I was trying to figure out how to put it in the book, but it's just too small. But when I'm stressed out and I'm at home, when I'm in any sort of familial situation, even if in my wife's family or whatever, I will run to Target. It's just a chance. It's my cigarette break. It's my drink. It's my thing. You know, it's just like, there's a comfort. There's a, like, it, I guess it's the reason why there's a million Olive Gardens and not a, you know, there's a lot of Italian restaurants, but there's a chain restaurant. There's just the safety and familiarity to it. I get that.
Can you describe for the audience the video store in your bedroom?
Yeah, absolutely. Video stores were new, and it wasn't Blockbuster. It wasn't, you know, it was mom and pop video stores. And going in there, it felt like you were shopping for a diamond. At least the one that I went to, like every videotape was behind a piece of glass. You'd have to write down a number, give it to the counter. Like, nope, we don't have never ending stories. Try again, go back out. Okay. What do I run around? And it just felt like, and you know, on some level, I wanted to be in movies and TV, not because I wanted to be an actor. It's just like, I just wanted to be on that other side. And early on in this process, I felt like I was brought in, like the guy that ran this video store liked me. And he's the one who gave me that Eddie Murphy cardboard cutout. He gave it to me and I had it. And I was like, take home. It was like, it was an ad for a video store. I still have it in my office. It's like, take home 1987's Blockbuster hit. You know, and then on the back, there was like a thing. It was like, you know, $99.99 for, you know, this much. And here's a discount. I was like, I'm getting the inside scoop. These tapes are expensive. I felt like I just was in the world of movies, and it kept on kind of growing. And I wanted to make my own video store. And and I would tape movies and have them off of pay-per-view, and I would start to deal them out in school. Teachers would come up to me, "You have Ferris Bueller's Day Off?" "Yeah, I do." You know, I gave it to my teacher, and you know, it's like, and then my teacher would be like, you could pick any movie for movie day. Okay, great. I had the.
Paul, you weren't just taping movies off TV. Yeah. You were taping movies off TV while sitting close enough to the VCR that you could smash the pause button when you could feel they were about to go to commercial.
Oh, 100%. That's the way you had to do it. I mean, any other way is disrespectful. You know, I'm not going to sit there and even watch a smidgen. You knew when it started to go to black, bam, pause. Wait, it was exacting. It felt so good. It's like making a great mixtape, you know? And, you know, I mean, talking about Eddie Murphy again, I had tapes of, I would sit down with the TV guide and a yellow highlighter, and I would go through the TV guide and be like, okay, I'm going to watch this, going to tape this, and watch these late night shows. And so much so that I would tape late night appearances. I taped every Eddie Murphy late night appearance, which is not many, but there was enough. And then I had a two VCR system. This is as I got a little bit older. And I would like sit there and just cut the Eddie Murphy pieces out. So I just have a tape of just interview segments of Eddie Murphy, you know, like that was there. So I did all this stuff.
This is how hip hop was born.
I mean, truly, I wish I had more of a discernible skill, like reel to reel. But I was literally like, I was like, Superman 2 on TV has extra scenes that the Superman movie that I rented doesn't. I'm gonna splice in the scenes that I saw from the TV edit of Superman. I did it all. I loved it. It was a sad day when TiVo came. Although I loved the TiVo, it was like that tactile sense of pause, record. Like that was so fun to me. I mean, I made my own radio shows, right? Put in commercials. I'd tape commercials to put into a radio show that I would play for no one, you know, but just to do a radio show.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, the story of the time that as a child, Paul Scheer met Christopher Walken, and Walken put his hands on Paul's shoulders, looked deep into his eyes, and told him this, ... We'll get into it. It's Bullseye for MaximumFun.org and NPR.
You're listening to Bullseye with Jesse Thorne on KPR, Kansas Public Radio. From the University of Kansas, we're 91.5 Lawrence, 89.9 in Atchison, and online at kansaspublicradio.org. Hope you'll stick around at noon today. It's This American Life with Ira Glass, followed by Trail Mix with your host, Bob McWilliams. Our forecast today is for sunny skies in the KPR listening area, highs in the upper 80s, a little warmer tomorrow, low 90s, with continued sunshine, breezy south winds. It's Kansas Public Radio.
I'm Kevin Ferguson, senior producer here at Maximum Fun, a worker-owned cooperative. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and BritBox, dedicated to helping people discover a world of British TV, including new original crime thriller Blue Lights, set in the streets of modern Belfast. Streaming at BritBox.com/NPR. And Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest this week is Paul Scheer. He's an actor and a comedian. You might have seen him on Veep, Parks and Recreation, The League. Earlier this year, he wrote a book, Joyful Recollections of Trauma. It's a memoir about his childhood, the abuse he suffered at the hands of his stepfather, and mixed in with all that, a bunch of funny stuff, I promise. He and I talked in front of a live audience at NPR member station, LAist 89.3. You started doing improv as a teenager. Mm-hmm. You and your dad had been going from Long Island, where you grew up, into the city to go see short-form improv. And your dad took you to an improv class that turned out to be a regular adult improv class.
Yeah, because we got obsessed with improv. It was so fun. It was unlike anything I have ever seen. And I wanted to take this class. And my dad was like, yeah, well, go take it. And, you know, it's funny, again, as a young, I'm 14 years old at this point. And I'm like, I'm taking a class. Like, I've never taken a class where there's not just a bunch of 14-year-olds in it. You know, and I walk into this class, and it's all people in their late 20s and early 30s. And you'll net, like, the shock of that, being in a class full of adults and then feeling young, was so daunting that I lied. And they said, well, how old are you? And I'm like, oh, I'm 18. It's only 4 years more at that point. I thought I could pull that off. I just started college at NYU. No, I just started high school in Long Island, you know, and I'm like, okay. And and they're like, oh, what are you doing? And I'm just lying. Oh, I live on Long Island because it's cheaper. Oh, city rents, I don't even know what I'm saying. I'm doing these scenes and it's like, oh, okay, you're in a therapist's office. I don't know what that is ultimately. Like, yeah, I went to therapy like once or twice when I was a kid, like I told you, but not like this. Or it's like, oh, you're driving in a car. I've never driven a car. You know, I'm doing all these adult scenes, you know, like, and it's like, oh, my husband wants to divorce me. I'm like, hey, you know, like I am play acting as an adult, like, and I'm learning. And, you know, when I don't, you know, when I make a mistake, they're like, oh, that's a funny choice. I'm like, yes, it was definitely a choice, not my lack of knowledge of what adults say and do. So much so that, like, I would go out after class. I begged my dad, I was like, can you not pick me up after class? Can you let me wait a little while? We'll go out to lunch with these people and hang out with them. And one time, one of the people I was in class with, like, pulled out a joint as we were walking in Central Park. And I was very... a kid that really wasn't around drugs, wasn't really around like a lot of alcohol. And we pulled out a joint. I freaked out. I was like, this is a drug. Whoa, drug addict. What the hell? What's going on? This guy's addicted. I'm like, did you see that? I was like shocked at the slightest joint that you would ever see. And I remember because I had given out my number to people in that class, and they would call me during the week, like, hey, what's up? You want to come get a drink? No, I'm exams, I remember I was talking to one of the women on the phone that was in my class, and we're talking, and I was like, can you believe that guy had a joint? He had a joint. And she's like, yeah, so? And I'm like, oh, I mean, do we need to call somebody? Is he like, yeah, we need to call somebody. Like, who do we call? Like, I was like, I was obsessed that this person was a drug addict. So there's those things. And, I didn't put this part in the book, but there's this moment where years later, now I am a freshman in college. I am at NYU, going there to be a teacher. And I start going back to Chicago State Limits is where I started taking this class, and I'm working the box office. And that woman who had called me came back in, and the person who was running the theater was like, oh, did you know, this is Paul. He's just moved, you know, he's new. He just came, he's a college freshman. And she was, and it was like, I just saw like her. I'm like, you know, I'm like, wait, what? And I was like, yeah. Like at this moment where we had this, like, so you lied to me for like that year and a half. I was like, yeah, I did. And you know, like, there was like this weird moment of, you know, I was caught, and it was just like this nice moment, but also like, yeah, for a long time I was living this lie of being this, you know, I told them all that I did a semester abroad. That's why I couldn't take level two. It wasn't because it was on a Wednesday. I could take the class with them on Saturdays, 12 to 3, because that was easy to do. I couldn't take a Wednesday 7 to 10 class. So I said, oh, I'm doing a semester abroad. And then I was able to get rid of them and never see them again. But yeah, so I was finally busted years later.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Paul Scheer, comedian, actor, and author of the new book, Joyful Recollections of Trauma. I'm sort of like a proxy for the audience here, and I think everybody's probably thinking about the question you avoided answering, which is, how did you become a Clippers fan?
Yeah, well, you know what? I was about to bring that back.
Long Island.
I'm from Long Island. I grew up a Knicks fan. I love the New York Knicks. Saw all these New York Knicks games. Knicks are a team that is tough to follow. You know, we got close and couldn't get it. And I moved out here to LA.
It's not a gravy train like the Clippers.
Yeah, right. Amen. And
So tired of these front-running Clippers fans.
You know, and I came out here, and I knew that I was going to be in Los Angeles. And probably I was going to have kids at one point. And wouldn't it be fun to have, like, a team that they could like? I don't love it when I meet kids from L.A. who's like, we are Cleveland Cavs fans. I'm like, well, are you really? Just be the fan of the thing that you are. Like, you're in the town. Be in the thing. I was like,
Paul,
I want to.
My kids are Giants fans. I want to make that clear.
You know, my kids are Kansas City Chiefs fans. I don't know why, but it's the whole household adopted that. But I wanted to have this experience with my kids. I want to be like, this is our team. I'm not going to wait for the two times a year the Knicks come and play the Knicks can play the Lakers and the Clippers. We're going to be Clippers fans. It was a fun time to get involved. Doc Rivers was there. CP3, Blake Griffin. It was like, okay, this would be fun. And it was cheap. And I didn't have money. I couldn't go from Knicks to Lakers. That felt cheap. That felt like I was cutting ahead. And it felt like I couldn't do that. So yeah. I became a Clippers.
No disrespect to people born into Lakers fandom.
Oh, gosh, I love
but
Lakers
if you
fans.
Chose it, you're probably a jerk.
Look, here's the thing. I understand that America's basketball team is the Lakers. I understand that for a certain population, Dallas Cowboys are probably, maybe that's changing now, but like there are just, those are the teams. When I go to LAX, yes. Are there only Clippers jerseys up at the store? Sure. That's weird, but okay, but you know, it's changing. It's slowly changing. And I just think it's been so fun to have this like thing. And I've gotten so into it in multiple ways. I think that there's something really fun about sports. I'm not like a jockey kind of person, but I love the drama of a team. I love the ups and downs. I mean, it sounds silly to say, but the improvised nature of it. They win, they lose. You don't know what the outcome is going to be. It's surprising. New things come in, new things come out. My son is so into basketball and it just becomes like, I don't know. I think as a fan, as a collector, as all these things, I have just really given over to this and it's a high and low thing. I've had a lot of great friends, and I think that there's an underdog status to it that's really fun. We'll get them next year. is a nice way to be. You know, it's like it I think for all of us, especially in this town. All right, let's try it again. You did something. It worked. It didn't work. Here's the thing. This is the joke about this town in a weird way. Like you do something and it works, and people are like, "Well, what do you got next?" And there's no guarantee that that next thing is going to work. You do something that doesn't work, and it's like, well, I got to do the next thing. And you just have to keep on going. And there's something about the Clippers in some way. They've been through a racist owner who made them reuse bandages, right? They went through this thing where, like, in the middle of the first time they're ever getting any success, a racist tape of that same owner drops, you know, that shocks the NBA. And so much so the players like, should we not play? Cause we don't want to play for this racist, you know? And then they get this player, the transformative NBA player. Then he gets injured and he's out for like, first of all, he gets injured in the playoffs and then he's out for a year. And there's this up and down, but you get back up and you keep on going. And there's something really interesting about sports. Like you can't quit. That long after I'm dead, the Clippers, you know, will be going the same way. Like, you know, it's like, there's something about that, like that. I like that energy. It's like, keep on going. Here we go. Another season, new thing. Let's go. And it's a good memory for me to be like, move on. Next game, move on. And I think it's an important thing in life and in every, as a parent, as a partner, as a creative, it's like, all right, learn from that. And you got to keep on going forward. You can't just keep on watching the tape from the last game. You got to go to the next game.
Paul, when you were a kid, you and your dad made a trip to California. You bought a guide to shooting locations.
Yes.
So that you could stalk celebrities.
Right. Well, let me tell you, I didn't buy a guide. Like there's a place in Beverly Hills where you pay $75 and they give you every shooting location in Los Angeles for that day. And you could just go and show up. Right. It was a stalker's dream.
Yeah, just look up stalker in the yellow pages.
Yes.
And
it was a time when they brought me into sets. Do you want me to tell that?
So, okay. So I'm just, we're running out of time. So I'm going to give you the setup here.
Okay.
The setup is, you've seen some celebrities, very successful day. You go to an interior shoot where Christopher Walken is shooting. You know him as the bad guy in a Bond movie. Your favorite Bond movie at the time.
Vito Kill, the best.
And this is going to be the disappointing conclusion of the day, because when people are shooting in interior, there's no way for an outsider to get in. But a security guard says, you want to meet Mr. Walken, you have to leave your dad behind and go into this room alone.
No parents, no cameras.
So far, that up to that point, this story, truly horrifying.
Right. Yeah, when people hear no parents, no cameras, they're like, wait, what's going to go on? I'm led into this warehouse. The door closes behind me. Security guard stays outside. The door is open just a little bit, so just so enough, like a slit of light comes in. And out of the darkness appears Christopher Walken, who's shooting a movie called Communion, where he communes with aliens. And I only bring this up because at this point, he's been captured by aliens. He is in white face to a certain degree. Not mummin' shants, but like white and sparkles. He looks like Jacob from, or Edward from Twilight. And it freaks me out because I know him as the James Bond villain. And, you know, I have my little autograph book in hand, and I just think it's going to be like, can you sign my thing? And he wants to talk, you know, and you know, he's like, the light hurts my eyes. And I'm like, okay, great. And he's like, explain why we're in darkness. And he's like, do you believe in aliens? No one's ever asked me this. I'm like, yes. And he's like, good. We're making a movie about aliens. You know, they bring me to this ship. And I'm like, yeah, I know. I'm listening. And I am in the Disney World mode of pen and autograph pad. Like, not ready for this. And he gets down on his hands and knees. He puts his hands on my shoulders. He pulls me in and he goes, don't let anyone tell you what you can or cannot do. And he releases me, signs my autograph. Sends me on my way. And that was me meeting Christopher Walken. And it was an amazing experience. It truly was, like, again, because I also didn't know him. Like, I didn't really know him. And as years have progressed, I'm like, oh, I actually met Christopher Walken, you know? One of the best. And, a little side note, not in the book. My dad's a pharmacist. And I didn't have an autograph pad. I had a prescription drug pad. So, and it was like one that like wholesalers give out. So Christopher Walken's signature is on a notepad that is advertising Valium.
Paul Scheer, as we said, his new book is called Joyful Recollections of Trauma. It is hilarious and harrowing. Go grab it at your local bookstore. Thanks so much to the folks at The Crawford at LAist 89.3 for hosting me and Paul. If you're in Los Angeles, want to hear about all the great live events that they're putting on, go to laist.com/events. And hey, go check out the LAist YouTube page. You can watch fully professionally produced video of this interview or share it with somebody. That's the end of another episode of Bullseye. Bullseye created from the homes of me and the staff of Maximum Fun in and around Greater Los Angeles, California. Here at my house, I just got a refill on my oxygen tank. Yes, that's right, folks. Remember 3 years ago when Kareem Abdul-Jabbar told me to try an oxygen tank for my migraines? I got one, and it helps. This show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson. Our producers are Jesus Ambrosio and Richard Roby. Our production fellow at MaxFun is Danielle Huesias. Our video producer is Daniel Spear. We get booking help from Mary Davis. Special thanks this at LAist who hosted my conversation with Paul Scheer. We had such a great time. Thank you to John Cohn, Rebecca Stummy, Tony Federico, Kristen Payne, Kristen Ranger, and Laura Dukes, and Michael Leva, big crew over there at LAist. So much love to all the folks in Pasadena. We really appreciate it. Our interstitial music is by DJW, also known as Dan Wally. Our theme song is Huddle Formation by The Go Team. Thanks to The Go Team. Thanks to their label, Memphis Industries.
Bullseye is on Instagram at Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. I am on Instagram at Jesse Thorne, very famous. Follow me, follow Bullseye. We're also on Twitter, YouTube, and Facebook. YouTube is an easy place to find our interviews and share them. I think that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place to find NPR News, Kansas Public Radio. We're KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City, KANQ Chinook. Listen online at kansaspublicradio.org or tell your smart speakers to play Kansas Public Radio. No matter how you get the news of the day in your car, at the office, at home, or on the go, your support ensures that KPR will always be your place for news about the things that really matter to you, whether they occur around the globe or down the street. KPR never lets up in its commitment to serve our listeners because you matter. Make a difference. Donate now at kansaspublicradio.org. We'll see a sunny day today in the KPR listening area, highs in the upper 80s. It's Kansas Public Radio.
This week, on Live at Green Lady Lounge, it's two of KC's best guitar players, Danny Embry and Rod Fleeman, and their band Wiretown. David Bassey here. Hope you'll join us live at Green Lady Lounge, Saturday at 6 p.m. on KPR.
There's certain things you should really only say to your best friend. This is probably one of them.
You ever just shut up and just listen to somebody?
Go right ahead.
That's what
pisses
you off. Spill it out there, brother. I already did.
Tom and Scott are in an all-night diner around midnight. Scott is disheveled and tired. He's been working all night as a bartender at a Chinese restaurant, serving lots of free drinks on the sly to Tom. And Tom, in response, seems astonishingly ungrateful. Here is the kind of sass that Tom keeps throwing Scott's way.
You're the one who needed the food and the beers and all that stuff like that to calm down after your traumatic night stealing from your employer.
Really?
Just at that moment, a man in a Hawaiian print shirt and khaki pants walks by their table. He hears the word employer, mistakes it for the word lawyer, and then turns to Tom.
Are you a lawyer?
No.
No. Do you want to be?
Who brought up lawyer to start with? You just came walking in. No, I didn't. Not at all.
He didn't say lawyer.
You thought that you heard something, and then you let your mind take over, and then it got you, and
I am a lawyer, so that's probably why I might have thought that. But you know what? Right. I'm trained in the art of listening, and because Sworn you said you wanted to be a lawyer.
I definitely wouldn't hire you because you heard completely wrong.
Really?
Yeah.
There's some conversations that you overhear, and it's hard not to want to keep listening or to butt in, even though everybody knows that it is not the right thing to do.
One Sunday morning, a while back, I was sitting in one of the booths in this very diner, the Golden Apple in Chicago on Lincoln Avenue, and I looked around the restaurant. At the table next to me, a family was taking their teenage daughter out to an awkward last breakfast where she shipped out with the military. There were dressed-up people who'd come in from the church across the street, and young couples who'd stumbled in with the paper and were working on the crossword together. And I thought, if only somebody could interview every person at every table in this restaurant, that would be amazing. You get such a wide variety of different kinds of stories from different kinds of people. So, we decided to try it. One Friday night, a big group of us took shifts, starting at 5 a.m. and going to 5 a.m. the next morning. During quiet hours, it was just one of us on duty, recording and interviewing people. During the busiest hours, which means late night, Three or four of us worked the tables. The first broadcast today's program all the way back in 2000, and we're rerunning it again today. From WBEZ Chicago, today's show, 24 Hours at the Golden Apple. This American Life, I'm Ira Glass. Stay tuned.
It's 5 o'clock in the morning. My name is Pete. I work from 10 p.m. to 5 a.m. And now we're going to have the taxi drivers and the cops, you know, come for a cup of coffee until 6 o'clock. The morning crowd is going to be in.
Pete's one of the three owners of this restaurant, along with Nick and Tom. All three are Greek, and one of them is always there, 24 hours a day. The restaurant sits at one of those intersections where three streets come together, not two. So every one of the corners in the intersection is wedge-shaped, which means that the restaurant itself is wedge-shaped, with booths along the windows on two sides of the wedge. There's a counter with stools and a larger room with tables in the back. There are those oversized laminated menus that go on for pages, pages, with pictures of the food. By the door is one of those revolving dessert cases, an octagon made of glass, three shelves of cream pies and melon slices and cakes. Lately, I've been nothing but trouble. Here's Nick, another one of the owners.
It's supposed to be turning. It's not turning because the motor broke. Jimmy's supposed to come out like 3 days ago. He's still coming. Now, if you can figure this one out. The pie case is not turning, and believe it or not, it's not selling as good. That's the truth.
Dessert sales are down, he says, by half, ever since it broke. People just like desserts more when they're in motion.
It catches the eye. You know, when it's turning, it catches the eye, and it sells.
Over the course of 24 hours, the staff of the Golden Apple changes, the regulars who come in change, and the atmosphere changes. From quiet in the early morning, crazy hectic late at night when the bars in the neighborhood let out. Nancy Updike took the first shift of our 24-hour surveillance, mic in hand, from 5 a.m. till 10 a.m.
This is Eddie. He comes to the Golden Apple a few times a week in the mornings and plays the harmonica in the middle of the restaurant for a few minutes. He's in a pale blue shirt and hopping lightly from foot to foot.
I might fall down.
Eddie heads to the back of the restaurant to play there. No one is complaining. No one is rolling their eyes. In fact, a few people are smiling and saying hi. Eddie is not an outsider here. He's a regular. Early morning at the Golden Apple is like that, a profoundly democratic place. Early morning welcomes the night shift workers, the unemployed, the retired, the confused, the disappointed, the slightly off, the people who work for themselves, and the people who don't work at all anymore, but crave a little morning routine.
Every morning I'm here between 4:30 and 5. I love the Golden Apple. They're wonderful people. They got good food. And that's it.
This is how Joe Molica ends every sentence.
And that's it.
Or sometimes...
And that's all I could tell you, honey.
Joe's not used to talking about himself. His story comes out bit by bit. Our entire conversation takes place in a different era. He's completely unselfconscious about calling me honey. He bangs on his coffee cup with his spoon to get the waitress's attention for a refill. Please don't try this at home. But he gets away with it.
I do construction, remodeling, rehab. And that's what I do. I retired. I'm 78 years old. And I gave the business to my two sons. And that's it.
How did you start that business?
To my dad. My dad done the same thing when I was, I don't know, maybe 10, 11 years old. I started working for him. He was paying me a dime an hour. And that was it. Clean up, sweep up the floors that he's working on. What else you want to know, honey?
At 5:30 in the morning, almost everyone is sitting alone. By choice, it seems. Joe's friend Bob is sitting in his own booth behind Joe. No one's talking much, but it's a comfortable silence. When you're up this early, it's hard not to feel some sense of community with everyone else who's awake. But you don't necessarily want to talk to them. As it gets lighter and lighter outside, more people trickle in.
A guy with thick, dark blonde hair and a face that looks like it could use another 6 hours sleep sits down at the counter. His name is Scott Johnson, and he says he usually comes in around 3:30 a.m., but today's different.
It's about 20 after 7.
How did you start coming to the Golden Apple?
I own a bar right down the street. It's called Wits, and I own another one on Clark and Oakdale called Jake's.
How did you get into the bar business?
Oh, boy. About 8 years ago, I turned 30, quit my career, got a divorce, and bought a bar in the same month.
Oh, my God.
Took the Etch-A-Sketch and shook it. Stood it upside down and shook it real hard and changed my life forever.
It's completely light outside now. Commuter traffic is picking up. The Golden Apple isn't crowded, but all the front booths are taken and most of the counter. Nick keeps getting deliveries, orange juice, potatoes, and his butcher comes by, John Zervis. John is a big man in that way that's the norm in Chicago. Not fat, just big. John has been eating at the Golden Apple and supplying its meats for 10 years. When he was 8 years old, he became famous for being the youngest butcher in Illinois.
Back in 1979, I was interviewed by Fahey Flynn. I don't know if you remember, back in 1979, Fahey Flynn was a well-known newsman right here, Channel 7 News, before he died in 81. I was the youngest butcher in Illinois in 1979. And, I've met Governor Thompson down Randolph Street. My father was in the retail business, too, on Randolph Street, and that's how I started learning how to cut. So I've been doing this for, I'm 33 now, and since I was like 8 years old.
You were a butcher when you were eight?
Well, yeah, I've been involved, cleaning tables, and about 12 years old, I started cutting meat on a bandsaw.
Wow. Do you remember the first piece of meat you cut?
Pork chops. Piece of pork loin, and I sliced it. I remember very well, like it was yesterday. And real slow on a bandsaw, pork chops. Pork loin's like 18 pounds. First thing I did is cut it down the middle and start from the middle. The trick is at the end not to cut your hands when it comes really small. You got to use a special kind of thing that's underneath the bandsaw, not to put your hand in it, because the bandsaw doesn't have any friends. I mean, if it's going to grab your hand, it's going to cut it.
The front of the Golden Apple is the smoking section. Sitting there is a grayish woman with a fleshy face and wavy hair in one of the small two-person booths. Her name is Alice DeLuca.
I work at a purification center. It's sauna, running, vitamins and minerals. It's a program to rid your body of toxins and radiation.
Wow. Have you done the program yourself?
Yes, I have.
Now, to the naked eye, it looks like you're smoking and drinking coffee and about to have some sausage. Yes. So how does that square with the whole toxins thing?
Well, I'm trying to wake up.
You need some toxins to wake up.
I guess so.
The restaurant never gets crowded this morning. Turnover is slow. People linger over their coffee or their conversation. It's a weekday, so there's no impatient brunch crowd waiting for tables to open up. And if you don't have an office you need to get to, why rush? Donna, the waitress, is finishing up the night shift and getting ready to go home. She's been on since 11 p.m., but you would never know it to look at her. She's 6 feet tall and looks like Catherine Deneuve. She's one of the most beautiful people I've ever seen in person.
How long have you been working here?
26 years.
Wow. How old were you when you started?
Well, you think I'm going to tell you that? Are you kidding? My kids don't even know how old I am.
Donna says she's actually not a night person, but she's worked the night shift the entire time, all 26 years. She came to Chicago from Oklahoma City in her early 20s with 3 kids.
I was divorced when I came here. And I had married so young, had my children young, no education, and I had a little baby. That's why I started working nights. But this is a great job for that. I mean, working nights, that way you're with them during the day. You don't sleep much, but when they're sleeping, you're working. And I'm still working the night shift. I don't know why, but I still am.
Every Christmas Eve, Donna brings in a big tray of homemade cookies for the homeless guys and the old men and the taxi drivers, anyone who shows up that night. Every once in a while, on her afternoon off, she'll go see a play starring one of the actors who come in every night after their own shift waiting tables. Her customers give her tapes of the bands they're in, bring in their artwork for her to see, tell her about their successes and failures. These are people she's known for years.
It's like home here to me. And when I think about, you know, going on a day job, I just can't. It's almost like it'd be another, you know, a separation, because it's like home when you've been here this long.
Donna runs her shift at the Golden Apple with a lot of compassion and generosity. But like any good waitress, she's also ruthlessly practical. She can be direct when she needs to. Early morning is no time to stand on ceremony.
Oh, honey, I gotta get finished with the rest of my work.
All right. Are you doing anything to set up or clean up?
I gotta check and see what I got to do.
Can I just follow you around and you tell me what you're doing? I'll just like.
Well, I don't even know if I have anything more to do. I just didn't want to talk anymore.
Oh, okay.
I didn't want to be rude.
No, you're
shut. I'm tired of talking.
In the middle of the day, a muted light streams through the windows, through a pale haze of cigarette smoke. At certain hours, it feels like everybody is smoking at the Golden Apple. Three industrial smoke eaters on non-stop. At lunch, some customers come in, eat quickly, and head back to work after just a half hour. But they're in the minority. Probably three-fourths of the customers are regulars. Many of them stay for hours. Nick, the owner, says some come two or three times a day.
I mean, they go home and sleep, of course, but this is their base. We got Charlie right now in the restaurant that comes twice, three times a day. Floyd, which is right next to him. Mitch with his son on the counter. He's a counter man. Mr. Harlan there with Steven. They come twice a day. Russ comes about three, four times a day. Al, two, three times a day.
At the counter, a man who looks a little bit like the actor Harry Dean Stanton, scruffy and lean, is here for the second time in 24 hours. He gives me what he says is his nickname, Robert. He says he usually just comes for coffee. Can't afford much else.
So why do you come here?
This is something to do. Coffee. You can't move here because I'm single, no wife, no girlfriend. No kids either.
Robert is one of three different men who tell me that they come here in the afternoon to drink coffee and talk to the waitresses. All three actually seem a little shy and intimidated by the waitresses. Robert is so bashful, he has a hard time saying much of anything to them.
I never said more than hello, or goodbye.
Really?
That's all I ever said. I don't know what to do with a girl, with a pretty girl. What to say? I don't know what to say.
At a table in the back, Manuel Hernandez is here for the second time today. He's a retired carpenter. Came to Chicago from Mexico in 1965. Was one of the workers who built the Sears Tower downtown, one of the tallest buildings in the world. He quit, he says, when they got to the 105th floor.
It was too windy up there. After two guys, they fall down, and then I quit. Because I don't want to be the next.
As the afternoon passes, he calls over one of the waitresses, Sherry, and asked her for help reading a document that he got in the mail from an insurance company. He's worried it's some kind of scam. She reads it, tells him no, they've sent him a check. It's real. Sherry says this kind of thing happens all the time. Some of these guys, who else do they have to turn to? Out on the sidewalk, when the weather's good, the restaurant sets up tables. At one, Allison Musgrave and her two kids are eating. Ian is four, Madeline is two. Both are wearing their bicycle helmets at the table and eating the Mickey Mouse pancakes. Three pancakes, arranged in violation.